Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Hiking the Appalachian Trail is a challenge for anyone. 2,200 miles from Springer Mountain, Georgia, to Mount Katahdin, way up in Maine. Anyone can try it. Most don't. Rahawa Hale did it as a young, solo African-American woman. Turns out that's rare. People of color in general are underrepresented in America's national parks and great outdoors. This hour on Point, Rahawa Hale tells us her story, south to north, 2,000-plus miles, on the Appalachian Trail. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you done it? Walked the Appalachian Trail? Was it a white world? Why? Joining me now from Berkeley, California is Rahawa Hale, essayist and short story writer. She hiked the Appalachian Trail, all 2,190 miles of it, last summer, and she wrote about her experience in the latest issue of Outside Magazine. Headline, Going It Alone. You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Rahawa Hale, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me.
Hold the terrain there. We'll come back to it for the grand finale.
Okay.
How long did it take for race to show up as an issue?
As an
gender,
issue?
Too, for that matter, if you like, on the trail.
As an issue, it was
to
never
your mind.
An issue. And, okay. I mean that nobody made it an issue for me. Nobody made it difficult on the trail, as far as hikers are concerned, through hikers, to be me. Every through hiker I encountered was incredibly welcoming and incredibly kind. And I think, as I've said this before, and this will not be the last time I'm saying it, but mm-hmm. the through hiking community is just one of the warmest and most open communities I've ever belonged
to.
Yes, but about those road crossings and about those trail towns, you know, it's not when did race become an issue to me on the trail. It's more when was I made aware of my race while walking through America, and that was, I mean, pretty much every other trail town in especially in the South. But you know, it never stops. You know, it's not like these towns are all white for a reason, just in the South. You know,
What was that like? What did you run into?
What did I run into? I mean, you know, the typical things that people run into even if they're not on the trail. People following me in stores when I'm resupplying. You know, just people staring at you. People just making comments like, we don't see much of your kind around here. The things that people feel at liberty to tell you when you're a hiker and when you're a black hiker is staggering. At least it was for me. But you know, I was often among these fellow through hikers, and I have a hard time imagining one of them wouldn't have stood up for me if they saw someone treating me poorly. And I say this not just as a black person, but as a woman. I mean, there's all kinds of masculinity on the trail. You know, the trail is mostly male, but there was also a lot of looking out for women, and especially for younger women. There are hikers as young as I think 15. There was one hiker, Pebbles. I want to say she was 15 or 16, and everyone looked out for her, especially the men. So there's a lot of support among through hikers. But it's, you know, it's one of the hard things for me was I'd be in town and I wouldn't be able to share that anxiety with anyone.
You can join us this hour. Why would the Appalachian Trail and maybe other American wilderness or outdoor spaces be generally so white? What is that about? And are African Americans, let's say, not interested, not welcome, just not tuned into the great outdoors? Really? And what's your question for Wahala Hale on her hike or her experience on hiking while black? I mean, this is kind of a thing. There's even a group called Hiking Every Available Trail, HEAT. And Keona Dawson helped found the organizations aimed at encouraging more people of color to get outside. And she talked with National Geographic in February this year about growing up and getting into hiking as a young person of color.
I never saw people that really looked like me on the trails. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to, you know, have a father that was a lover of nature, too. And so at an early age, I remember one of our first national parks, we went to Yosemite. And I was just blown away. And we hiked up to the falls. And I've been hooked. I've been hooked ever since.
So I'm trying to get a sense. I mean, you wrote a lot about race here in your piece. And yet when you talk about the trail, it doesn't infuse what you're saying.
What do you mean?
Well, through hikers, awesome. I guess you're saying just demographically, you felt at some level like an outlier and less common as an African American hiking the trail.
Oh yes, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I definitely there. I think I ran into maybe 10 black people at most, and there was one meeting where four of us were there at the same time, and we talked about our experiences, and I think it was one of the most enriching nights for me, you know, just to have people who understood what the experience was like.
Share that conversation. What was the theme?
I mean, okay, well, so the other three people were men, and, you know, I mean, they're
African-American men who just happened to be at this hostel.
Yeah. And, you know, they talked about similar things, being followed in stores or worrying about if they were hitching with other hikers, if cars would stop for them, you know, if they saw them, you know.
And you're hitchhiking when you're off the trail and looking to get into town or supplies
exactly.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. Most trail towns are located a little while away, maybe 5 or 10 miles, and the easiest way to get there is by hitchhiking. And, you know, and of course, I mean, that was a concern for me as well. I mean, I never hitchhiked solo. I mean, I think maybe once if I couldn't help it, but for them, you know, I mean, there was just a lot of worry about how their presence would affect how other hikers are treated.
What do you think is the reason that you would meet only 10 African American hikers on this? It's this, anybody can go. It's wide open. It's always available. And you must have passed thousands of people over the course of 2,000 miles.
Yeah, I certainly did. Why so few through hikers, you mean?
African American, yeah.
Yeah, why so few African American through hikers? Well, racism, a history of racism in America, a history of vulnerability in the woods, a history of not having these activities being advertised and geared toward an African-American population, you know? I mean, we don't, most of these advertisements that you see for backpacking and for camping, they overwhelmingly are white and feature white people doing these activities. Through hiking in itself is a ridiculous thing to do. I mean, there aren't that many people, period,
right.
of any race who are going to do it. But you know, one of the things when I talk to people about how they got into thru hiking, you know, a lot of it's through family. You know, a lot of them went camping, you know, once or twice with their families or with friends and their families. And you know, exposure has a lot to do with that. And you're talking about people who, you know, were dealing with Jim Crow and dealing with with so much segregation and discrimination throughout the previous century. That's not there. I know many black people whose parents would never let them go camping, you know, when I was growing up. And so I think a lot of it has to do with that.
You quote Evelyn White from her essay in 1999, Black Women in the Wilderness, saying, she writes, "For me, the fear is like a heartbeat, always present while at the same time intangible, elusive, and difficult to define." And you write, "In wilderness, she does not see freedom, but a portal to the past, a trigger, the history of suffering too much to be overcome. It says to the minority, be in this place and someone might seize the opportunity to end you."
Let me get Javon calling from Tampa, Florida. Javon, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. My family, we grew up going camping and whatnot, so I think I got some early exposure. But I think for African-Americans who live in the rural communities, I think they and I could say we are engaging in the outdoors and maybe some place in ways that aren't being tracked. And that can be something as simple as going fishing or just enjoying a walk through the woods or something like that. There may not be at a national park, but my family and I, we get out to state parks and national parks when we can. But and I can't let it go unnoticed. I just got off the highway a few minutes ago or off some back roads in rural Polk County near Tampa, and I saw Confederate flags flying on some of the houses there. So I think the anxiety around who you might encounter when out in the wilderness is a very real thing when you see trucks with Confederate flags or other things that might indicate that somebody may have some prejudice. But I think that we enjoy being in the outdoors just as much as everybody else, but just as whether we're in the city or in a rural space, we have that extra concern about our safety given the history of the country and even what's going on today.
Their history is real.
Yeah, and John, I mean, you touch on two very important points, and ones that I write about in my outside feature, and that's what outdoors are we talking about? Because, you know, when we say, you know, an outdoorsy person is someone who backpacks and who climbs, then we're excluding so many people of color who do other activities. And I've met people. I have a friend who told me that she went trail running, you know, around Virginia near D.C., all the time, and she would never consider herself an outdoorsy person, even though the word trail is right in the activity's name.
Or people who fish, as Javon says.
Exactly, or people who fish, or people who do anything. And I think that needs to change. That definitely needs to change. And I'm so glad that you and your family enjoy camping. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, if a person doesn't feel comfortable in America, or if a person is anxious about their movement throughout America, it's not like they're going to be less anxious in a place where they're more vulnerable.
Yeah, Rahawa Hale writes about it for Outside Magazine. She's with us today from Berkeley, California.
A sensitive accusation for this administration is the theory held by many that the real reason the U.S. is so interested in toppling Saddam is control of the oil that Iraq is sitting on.
What about people who say you're only interested in the Middle East for oil?
What? Huh? Oil? Who says something about oil?
Generations ago, the Osage Indian Nation was forced to move. Not for the first time, white settlers pushed them off their land in the 1800s. The writer David Grand sees in that move the start of an astonishing and tragic story.
When they were being driven off their land in Kansas, they didn't know where to go. And an Osage chief stood up and he said, we should go to this area that would later become Northeast Oklahoma because it's rocky and infertile and the white man will finally leave us alone.
It turned out the Osage had chosen land that was rich in oil. In the early 20th century, members of this beaten-down Indian nation grew spectacularly wealthy. They bought cars. They built mansions. They made so much oil money that the government began appointing white guardians to help the Indians spend it. And then the Osage started to be killed. David Grand investigated their story for the new book, Killers of the Flower Moon. He tells this half-forgotten story beginning with Molly Burkhart, an Osage woman, in 1921. What happened to her?
So Molly Burkhart's family, she had four sisters, and one day in 1921, her older sister disappeared, and about a week later, her body was found in a ravine. Molly's mother, within 2 months, she too had died, and evidence later suggested that she had been secretly poisoned. Not long after that, Molly was sleeping in her bed. She heard a loud explosion, and she had another sister who lived not far away. And in the area where her sister's house was, she could see almost this orange fireball rising into the sky. And her sister's house had been blown up, killing that sister as well as her sister's husband and a servant.
It's still a little hard to get your brain around how it is that someone could commit all these killings and then inherit their oil wealth. Who would be in a position to do that?
What makes these crimes so sinister is that it involved marrying into families. It involved a level of calculation and a level of betraying the very people you pretended to love.
You mentioned Molly Burkhardt.
That's exactly what happened to Molly. She had married a white man, and his uncle was the most powerful settler in the area. He was known as the King of the Osage Hills, and he had orchestrated a very sinister plot played out over years where he directed his nephew, who had married Molly Burkhardt, to marry her so that he could then begin to kill the family members one by one and siphon off all the wealth.
How was this series of crimes investigated?
So it's really important to understand back then that there was so much lawlessness. That was one of the things that shocked me when I began researching the story, that even in the 1920s, much of America remained a country that was not fully rooted in its laws. Its legal institutions were very fragile. Molly Burkhardt beseeched the authorities to try to investigate, to get help, but because of prejudice, they often ignored the crimes. And almost anyone who tried to investigate the killings, they too were killed. One attorney tried to gather evidence, and one day he was thrown off a speeding train, and all the evidence that he had gathered had disappeared. Another time, an oilman had traveled to Washington, D.C. to try to get help. He was then found stabbed more than 20 times. And finally, a very obscure branch of the Justice Department intervened. It was known as the Bureau of Investigation, and it was what would later be renamed the FBI.
J. Edgar Hoover.
J. Edgar Hoover. He was the new director, and it became one of the FBI's first major homicide cases that it ever dealt with.
Did the agency that became the FBI solve these murders?
The Bureau initially badly bungled the case, and J. Edgar Hoover was new in the job, and he was very insecure. He had dreams about building a bureaucratic empire, and he turned the case over to a frontier lawman who put together an undercover team that included one of probably the only American Indian agent in the Bureau at the time. They were able, through some dogged investigation, to eventually capture some of the ringleaders.
Are you telling me that the future Federal Bureau of Investigation established its reputation as great investigators by subcontracting it out to somebody who actually knew what they were doing?
He did. They went to an old frontier lawman to help take over the case, and they did a good job. But Hoover was desperate to wrap up the case. The Bureau missed a deeper and darker conspiracy that remained unsolved, and I think that's very important to understand.
How do you know that?
Well, many of the Osage began to point me in directions to other unsolved cases within their families going back. What this story really is about, it's not about a story of who did it. It's a story about who didn't do it. When I went to the National Archives in Texas, there was this little booklet. It had a little fabric cover. All it was essentially identifying the name of a guardian and which Osage they were in charge of. And when I began to look at the names of the Osage under them, I could see written next to many of them simply the word dead, dead, dead. You're beginning to realize you're looking at hints of a systematic murder campaign, because there's no way all these people died in a span of just a couple of years. It defied any natural death rate. And then when you begin to look into each of those individual cases, you start to find trails of evidence of suggesting poisonings or murder. You start to try to trace the money and where the wealth went. What you begin to discover is something even more horrifying than the Bureau ever exposed.
When you've been poking around in this and revealing this information about a bunch of people's ancestors, what have people said to you?
So one of the things that you realize when you spend time in Osage County is that the descendants of both the victims and descendants of the murderers still live there. They often live down the street from each other. And one Osage woman told me, we try not to hold them accountable for what their ancestors did. Part of that is the story of America, this intertwining and this kind of reckoning with this original sin that is part of our formation of a country. And I would say this. I spoke with some of the descendants of the husband of Molly Burkhardt, mm-hmm. and the uncle, who was one of the masterminds of the plot. And they were remarkably candid, and after I finished the book, I received a note from one of the descendants who said, "I'm so ashamed that this is part of our history, and please, if you see the Osage, will you please tell them that?"
David Gran is author of the new book, Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Yo, check it out. It's just a friendly game of baseball.
When Jackie Robinson retired in 1957, the number of African-American players in Major League Baseball was increasing. By the 1970s, African-Americans made up close to 20% of all MLB players. That number stayed in the high teens through the early 90s, and then it dropped. By 2013, Major League Baseball was just 8.5% African-American. This is a story about one former major leaguer who watched that decline and who's now trying to reverse the trend. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Lou Collier grew up on the south side of Chicago during the 70s and 80s. He remembers wanting a better life. Collier's mom was a social worker. His father was a Vietnam vet who worked for Sherwin-Williams. They lived in the Roseland neighborhood.
You know, it was low-income housing. It was like a close-knit community. Nobody came in, nobody came out.
Collier spent weekends watching Cubs games with his dad on TV. He looked up to African-American players. Sometimes his dad told him stories about Jackie Robinson.
He just told me that it always looked like he was playing like it was his last day, you know, that he might not ever get another chance to do it. So he left everything out on the field. And I just remember that, and that's how I played.
Back then, Collier says baseball was all over the south side of Chicago.
Baseball was king in my neighborhood.
Collier's side of the neighborhood fielded a team. They called themselves the White Sox. They'd play the kids from the other side, the Royals.
It was like the World Series. We'd play each other in seven-game series, you know. The neighborhood was only so big, but one team would have their home field in one area of the neighborhood, and the other team had their home field in another area of the neighborhood. And the fields was makeshift field. They wasn't, I'm telling you, it wasn't 90 feet. It was just like, hey, okay, we're going to put the bases here.
Collier says the fields were too narrow because they were wedged between houses.
I remember guys hitting balls through apartment windows. But those games was intense. As a kid, it was everything to me. It wasn't no pickup game. It was like, man, you better come with it.
By the time he was 8, Collier was playing with 13-year-olds. He kept getting better, and he started seeing baseball as a way out. Collier went on to play at a nearby junior college. Then the Pittsburgh Pirates picked him in the 31st round of the 1992 MLB draft. Back then, Collier says there were 70 to 100 other African-American players in the Pirates organization. It wasn't always easy for them.
The opposing fans would say anything to try to distract you, whether they meant it or not. I've heard the N-word. I heard that my mom stinks, that I'm a bum. And then I realized, like, man, it must have been 10 times tougher for Jackie Robinson.
Collier says it all made him play harder. In 97, he got called up to Pittsburgh. 2 years later, he got picked up by the Milwaukee Brewers. They had a veteran African-American player, a guy named Marquise Grissom.
Once I made the team, he was like, man, don't worry about finding nowhere to live. You're going to live with me. It's like, man, are you serious? And he said, I got you. Don't worry about it. And that was a blessing. That was a blessing. You know, it just taught me how to be a professional. That right there changed my life.
Grissom also taught Collier something about being a mentor, but we'll get to that later. Collier spent 8 years in the big leagues, played for 5 different teams. And by the early 2000s, he started noticing something.
In the whole organization, it'd be 3 or 4 African-Americans. And I'm like, what is this? Can't be true. I would talk to guys, and I'd be like, how many brothers in the organization with y'all? They'd be like, 5. I was like, 5? Like, what kind of... I couldn't understand that. You felt like something wasn't right because you know that the talent is there. So what's the difference now?
There have been a lot of theories. Some say youth baseball has gotten too expensive. Some say scouts look for talent at fancy travel team tournaments, not in inner cities.
I can't pinpoint what the exact reasons were, but I told myself, you know what, I'm going to go back home and I'm going to teach the game to kids in my community. I'll do my part.
So after retiring, Collier went back to Chicago, started going to Little League games. A lot had changed. Kids' fundamentals were worse, like they weren't playing as often. Collier's friends told him that ever since Michael Jordan came to town, basketball was king. And then there was the violence.
Chicago is a rough, rough city. It's tough. The education system is failing. The gangs are bad. The murder rate is up. It's a lot of obstacles that kids have to endure on a daily basis, just living.
Collier decided to start a travel team. They would go to those expensive weekend tournaments where scouts would see them. He started recruiting players from community centers and little league games. He found sponsors to offset fees. That first year, he fielded two teams. Since then, the Lou Collier Baseball Association has grown and even lured in some basketball players. Take Josh Williams. A couple years ago, when he was 12, Williams showed up at a basketball gym and found Collier practicing baseball with his players. Williams poked his head in and asked,
"Can I join a team?" And then I looked at him like, "Man," I said, "where have you played?" He said, I never played before. I'm like, wow. But I looked at him, and he looked like he was serious, and he had a pretty athletic body. So we added him to the team. I told our head coach, I said, "We got a new player, a basketball player." And he just laughed. Like, man, what am I going to do with a basketball player that never played?
At the start of the season, Williams struck out every at-bat. At the end of the year, the team went to a tournament, reached the championship. Williams hadn't played much, but the night before the game, he said,
"Coach, I'm ready. I need to be in there." And I seen in his eyes, I'm like, man, okay. So the next day I told the head coach, I was like, "Man, get him in the lineup." I said, "Just put him in there." And he looked at me like I was crazy. I was like, "For real, I'm serious. Bat him ninth." And he was like, "All right, man." He put him in the lineup, man. This kid went 3 for 4, 2 home runs, and drove in like 7 runs. We were so excited for him. And he was like, "I told you, coach."
Now, Josh Williams is a high school sophomore. Collier says he has a good shot at landing a college scholarship. So far, dozens of kids from the Lou Collier Baseball Association have gone on to play college ball.
That's what was on my heart when I came back, to try to change lives like that.
The program now serves about 130 kids. Sometimes Collier tells them stories about Jackie Robinson. He says that they should never let negativity distract them from their dreams. And Lou Collier is optimistic that more African Americans will reach the big leagues. Just last year, Corey Ray from the South Side of Chicago was the 5th overall pick in the MLB draft.
Baseball is back happening in Chicago. Yeah, it's back happening.
Lou Collier, who grew up watching black players on television, hopes that someday soon, kids on the South Side of Chicago will turn on their TVs and see Corey Ray. And they'll believe, just as Collier did, that they can make better lives for themselves. For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Today we hear from a father who sat down with his teenage daughter for a difficult conversation about race. Calvin Burns has trouble getting 15-year-old Stephanie Bellamy to talk, something parents of teenagers everywhere can relate to. He hoped that doing a StoryCorps interview and sharing stories from his own teenage years might help. You should know their conversation includes a racial slur.
Growing up in school, I was usually the only black kid. And a lot of times I did feel left out. It was really tough, but I think it made me stronger being the outsider.
I can relate because going to high school, there's not people just like me. There's mostly white people.
How does that make you feel, being the only person there like that?
Sometimes it's kind of hard because, like, in history, when we're talking about slavery or something, a whole bunch of people will just turn and look at me. It makes me, like, say, like, "Yeah, I know, I'm black." Have you ever been called the N-word?
I've definitely been called that. And I think back to the time when me and my friends, this is when we were like 12 years old, and some guys in a truck drove close to us, and I can remember the guy saying, "Whoop, there it is, niggers." And the guys almost ran us over, and we were pretty upset. Have you ever been called that word before?
Yeah, just recently somebody called me that word. And some people, like, say go back to Africa or something like that.
This is not stuff I was aware of. I didn't know that kids like that existed at your school. Funny, I want you to know that you're not what they've been told you're like. It's kind of heart-aching to think about the stuff that I went through, and you're still going through those same things. I want you to know that if you ever feel scared or if these sort of things happen in the future, I mean, I'm always there for you to talk to me about them.
I don't know. I just never really like to talk about myself or things that, like, I go through.
So do you think by not talking about it that it's going to get better?
No, probably not.
I think you've done more talking today than you have in the last 12 months.
Yeah.
I really thank you for coming here with me and for getting outside your comfort zone. And I hope that we can have more conversations like this in the future. I love you.
Love you too.
That's Calvin Burns with his daughter, Stefani Bellamy, in Denver, Colorado. Their interview will be archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress.
White girl, 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 white girl.
I got that.
White girl.
A Chesterfield teen says she's being bullied at school because she's involved in an interracial relationship. Maddie Ridgway says she's been inundated with racist comments at Cosby High School.
Drew Wilder is live in Chesterfield tonight. Drew, her family believes that school administrators haven't done enough to address this issue.
Well, that's right, Heather, but the school district says that only one of these incidents was ever reported, and that was back in January. But the family wants other parents to know that the bullying hasn't stopped, and tonight Ridgway's mother says enough is enough.
They would say KKK to me, or they would say white power, KKK, Hail Hitler, white power, because she was dating black guys.
Maddie Ridgway says this is what she's dealt with in the hallways of Cosby High School. Ridgway says she complained to a school administrator in January, a report the school district confirms. She says when she did, the administrator wanted to know if Ridgway asked them to stop.
And I hadn't specifically said stop, but I had said, like, they can't do that, or, like, they knew it got on my nerves. But he basically said that there was, like, he couldn't do anything because I didn't say stop.
So the administrator said that he couldn't punish people for using racist comments unless you told them specifically to stop using racist comments.
To say yeah, basically.
Maddie says her friends tried to stand up for her, but it didn't help.
People around me would always be like, stop, you can't do that. And, I mean, they knew they couldn't do that.
How did it make you feel?
I mean, and aggravated, I guess that's why I had to leave, because I didn't want to, like, go crazy.
You left school?
Yeah.
We decided to pull her out of school, and she did homebound, which she was able to do that for 2 or 3 months, and then she had to go back because it's not a permanent solution.
But when Ridgway returned to Cosby a couple of weeks ago, she says the racist comments continued. Maddie admits she did not tell school administrators about the more recent incidents. The school system tells me it will work with any student who has a concern, but students need to report incidents as they happen. But Ridgway's mother says they've had enough.
We're actually planning on moving back to Vermont, we think, this summer to remove her from that school.
Now, the school district sent me a copy of a letter that went home to parents earlier this semester. It outlines Cosby's work to create what it calls a safe, supportive, and nurturing learning environment. But the district couldn't say whether or not that letter was sent home in response to complaints. We've posted the letter in its entirety over on NBC12.com if you'd like to take a look. Tonight, we are on your side live in Chesterfield County. I'm Drew Wilder for NBC 12 News.
Real friends. How many of us, how many of us, how many jealous real friends?
Over the past few years, since this nation has refocused its attention on race
At every level of society, there's a new spirit of seeking candor. Even anger over so-called political correctness is an acknowledgement that the old rules of passive complacency about race don't seem to work anymore. We've found that this re-examination can be most powerful in one-to-one conversations. Our series, Uncomfortable Truths, Confronting Racism in America, has curated some great examples already, and you've joined in. Jessica Shirak in Minneapolis emailed us with a story about her good friend Tiffany Wilson Worsley. Jessica's white, Tiffany is black. A few years ago, Jessica asked Tiffany, who she knew from a previous job, to meet her at a local coffee shop in northern Minneapolis, a predominantly black part of the city. Jessica wanted to leap over a frustrating barrier that keeps people of different races in different worlds in this country. Jessica had questions.
Tiffany was very open, and she told me, you know, I come from this predominantly black neighborhood, and I have parents who don't like white people. And somehow I felt upset that her parents wouldn't like white people, and it made me feel a little defensive. How could they not like white people? But, you know, I guess I keep thinking of this word tracks, like we're on different tracks. We live in different neighborhoods. We work at different places. We have different people for bosses, and we have different friend groups. And so I guess I felt like racially a little defensive, but it was also the start of feeling really curious about her life.
When I initially said that, and which is still true, I did let her know that when my parents refer to white people, they still use the other word.
The C word?
The C word that I cannot even say in a grocery store anymore because it's so jaded.
Crackers.
There it is.
Yeah.
So my parents still use that to refer to white people, and that's because their historical context.
Context.
Looking at behavior in context.
Is my mother was raised on a farm majority of her life, doing all of those ugly things, you know, to please the servants and, you know, the maids and things like that. And so although we're in 2017 and we live an entirely different lifestyle now, I think those memories are still resonate in my parents' mind. So when they say, hey, look at those crackers over there, they're not saying, oh, I hate them, but it's just that's them. They have no dealings with us. And that's a reality to me that I try to deal with even with my parents and some of my friends. And I think that's the kind of the temperament that I also lead with this work, is that we understand that certain ideologies still persist and consist in this day and time. And it's still live and real.
Mm-hmm. And I would say, as someone who grew up with family who said things about people who weren't white without knowing anybody who wasn't white, that there's an ideology that's really deep-seated.
Yep.
And that they're not aware of it. They just know they don't like certain people. And it's shocking that people would say those things, think those things, without having any direct experience. We went to a conference at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and it was the National Center on Difficult Dialogues conference. And we talked about living room conversations. And we were able to simulate a conversation on race with a really diverse group of people. And we had a great time. But it was also hard to be in a room of people who mostly weren't white and talk about having these cross-racial dialogues and feel challenged. What an example of a time where it got a little weird for me, but then I understood what other people's experiences must be like was when I was talking about something, but the black women in the room looked at Tiffany and addressed Tiffany for follow-up questions. They didn't necessarily address me. That's probably the experience of a lot of people of color in America every day.
After that experience, we were going to dinner that night.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were walking in the door, you said you needed a break. You need to go for a walk. And it was in that moment I thought of the pressure that you were or had experienced, and you needed to walk it off. And I thought to myself, I don't get that opportunity to do that.
Mm.
I can't, because this is my reality. And so that has been one thing that I've been thinking about, but never intentionally like got into until now.
Yeah.
I just didn't think me and white women had a lot in common. I think because I put them all in this one bucket of passive women who didn't have much to say and or contribute outside of beauty and hair and when I think of white women is just beauty. And I don't know if that's because that's how society lifts them, you know, because they're always the models, or look at what she has on, or, you know, she's size 4, the long hair, the straight long hair, because mine is not straight. So, of course, I always gravitate to those things that are obviously much more different than us. So as I began to do the living room conversations, I began to see her nose. I began to see the color of her hair, which meant I began to listen when she talked. So when she talked about her relationships, when she talked about her beautiful marriage and her beautiful daughter, I began to see my auntie and my cousins, when they talk about their beautiful marriages and their children, also her work. I already thought Jessica was a strong woman. So to hear her talk about her work and how she moved around in her work, it was just like, she is just like me. Now, I can honestly say I don't know that I hold that for still all white women. I need more white women friends. But for Jessica, I think she was a little bit more easier for me to see because I had already pegged her as someone who was strong and hardworking, and she cared about her appearance. And I, obviously those things are big for me, and I don't know why, but they are.
So can I bring up the hair thing? You mentioned it, the long straight hair.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot of things, and these, they might seem silly, but they weren't silly to me. I learned that black women sometimes, if they get their hair done for a particular kind of event, they might sleep sitting up in a chair because they don't want to ruin their hair, because it's important that it looks good the next day. Tiffany might, I mean, has a lot of familiarity with that, but I didn't know that. And it seems like a small detail of life, but it lets you know that we are having really different experiences in daily details of how we go about our lives. And it was really surprising to me that there were small things like that that I didn't know, like how to care for your hair, that every black woman is going to know, but most white women will not know. I didn't know that black women wore wigs. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. And then I went to Tiffany's apartment, and she had wigs at her house. And I was like, whoa, what's going on here? I don't know white women who have wigs. But now I know that small detail, but it helps me understand life just a teeny bit more from somebody else's perspective. And I think about other white women who are going to go through their lives having only white women friends and not knowing at all what it's like for someone who's not white to just get around in the world, to be in the world. And I think that is too bad for them.
That's Jessica Shurack and Tiffany Wilson Worsley. Now they are both participating in Living Room Conversations, a guided conversation project about helping people connect with others with differing perspectives. And we're grateful they were a part of our series, Uncomfortable Truths.
College don't mean shit. Y'all niggas, and you gonna be niggas forever, just like us, niggas.
I extend a heartfelt apology to my colleagues and to all of those I have offended.
State Senator Frank Artilles from Miami apologizing today for using racial slurs with Senate colleagues. Let's get to Local 10 News reporter Terrell Fournet. He's live in the newsroom to explain this controversy. Terrell.
Well, those offensive words were spoken off the Senate floor in a private conversation earlier this week. And this just in, because of those insults from the state senator who represents the Kendall area, he's been removed as chairman of the Communications, Energy and Public Utilities Commission.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I extend a heartfelt apology to my colleagues and to all of those I have offended.
State Senator Frank Artiles is in hot water this afternoon after admittingly using the N-word in a conversation with two fellow lawmakers, Senators Audrey Gibson of Jacksonville and Perry Thurston of Fort Lauderdale, who were both black, were on the receiving end of those comments.
With regard to the word,
N-words. Artiles later used a different form of the racial slur again in an attempt to apologize, but the damage had already been done.
I ask for your forgiveness.
Artiles, who created buzz in Tallahassee earlier this year for a move to end the state's express lanes, now making waves for these controversial comments. Senate President Negron and Senators Thurston and Gibson were all in attendance for that apology today on the Senate floor.
For me to denigrate your efforts and insult my fellow colleagues is an affront to you and the Senate.
And as you can imagine, there are now calls for Artiles to resign his Senate seat. But so far, there's no indication that he plans to do so. Live in the newsroom, I'm Terrell Fournet, Local 10 News.
American streets will be running red tonight when people release the beast.
The beast in Florida, a history of anti-black violence.
After Aramis Ayala decided not to seek the death penalty in the double murder case against Markeith Lloyd, or any case, she's been commended and criticized. But now she's received two threatening letters. According to a sheriff's office report, one letter that was addressed to Florida State Attorney Aramis Ayala appeared to have a racial message. In another envelope, Ayala's office found a postcard with a hangman's noose in green twine taped to the card. Ayala believes that the hangman's noose was meant as a threat to her as a public official.
She needs to be concerned about her safety.
Former Supreme Court Justice James Perry tells me Ayala must take the threat seriously.
Normally these things progress. You start up blowing off steam, then you do an act, and then the act accelerates. And that's the danger in that.
Perry and more than three dozen other former justices and attorneys have filed briefs in support of Ayala in her lawsuit against Governor Rick Scott for removing her from murder cases. The brief says the state attorney's discretion in deciding whether and how to prosecute is absolute.
It's a matter of separation of powers.
The governor is getting support from family members of murder victims who want the death penalty in play in Lloyd's trial and those of Sanal St. Simon, Daryl Avant, and others. Neither State Attorney Ayala nor a spokeswoman for the Orange County Sheriff's Office would comment further about the investigation into the two letters. Justice Perry believes the Ayala case will be heard and decided by the state's high court before summer. Jim.
Greg, thanks.
The Black Panther has been the protector of Wakanda for generations. The mantle passed from warrior to warrior. Now, because your friend murdered my father, I also wear the mantle of king.
You're listening there to Chadwick Boseman playing the Black Panther in his first ever movie appearance in last year's Captain America Civil War. The Black Panther isn't a new character. He was a creation of Marvel legends Stan Lee and Jack Kirby back in the 1960s. But the super warrior of the fictional African nation Wakanda is back now in a time when comic publishers are making their heroes more diverse, from a biracial Spider-Man to the Muslim Kamala Khan, a.k.a. Ms. Marvel. Last year, Marvel released its first Black Panther comic book since author Ta-Nehisi Coates took over the franchise in 2015. One thing Coates has done here is bring on fellow comic newcomers like journalist Rembert Brown to help write the new issues. Brown has previously covered politics, race, and pop culture for Grantland and New York Magazine. Today marks the release of Black Panther World of Wakanda number 6, The Return of Casper Cole. It's the first comic Brown has ever written, and he told John Hockenberry the deep roots of these characters made his work much more than just another checked diversity box for Marvel.
For me, the way I was approached to do the comic, it didn't really feel like I was jumping onto like a diversity train. Yeah. It was just like this was a character, like with the success of Black Panther in every wing of the Marvel Universe, right. The films, Ta-Nehisi's comics, like there was this character that, you know, because it was the Black Panther universe, go figure, was also a black character that got built out a little bit and was a character that had like a very short run in an earlier run, and then just kind of they never really did much with it and was a fan favorite. And I think that's why they're like, like I wonder what else we can do in this Black Panther universe. And so when it came to me and they asked me about it, and like I knew of the character in a very small amount, and when I kind of went back and did my research and read about it and thought of some of the parallels between the character and myself, I was like, this could actually be interesting, beyond just like a very cool experience for me to do, never having written a comic before.
Are there limitations to what you can do and how much of a storyteller you can be through characters like this because of the audience of comics, that the audience of comics hasn't traditionally been, you know, a diverse audience, an African-American audience, an African-American youth audience?
I'm very interested to see what the response is, because through writing online, writing for two mainstream publications, New York Magazine and Grantland, I have a lot of experience writing for non-black people.
Right, exactly.
And so,
right.
So that wasn't actually a worry for me. Like, I've kind of embraced writing for all eyes. And, you know, I embrace the role of coming at this from an educated outsider perspective, like not trying to write like a comic book writer, but also respecting the craft and learning the craft as I went along. And my editors who live and breathe Marvel Comics and know everything, they, you know, it wasn't like I went off for 3 months and came back and like, here's the comic. Like, we were working along the way. So it was, this is something that I'm used to. It's just a different medium.
But it's really an exciting time. As you say, you know, you're used to writing for non-black audiences. I mean, it reminds me of Jordan Peele. I mean, Get Out, it seems to me, is an example of a movie that crosses barriers and creates sort of like linkages that have never been possible before, and that the comic book is a place to do this as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say between watching Get Out and then a show like Atlanta, these are both two works of art that can't be defined by one genre. There are moments in Atlanta where it's the funniest show you've ever seen, and then it's the most serious show you've ever seen. There are moments in Get Out where it's hilarious, and then you're terrified. And I think that that is a moment that is beginning to happen more and more. And I don't think it's very surprising that a lot of the people that are doing this are black artists like a Donald Glover or Jordan Peele, who are very comfortable being black and talking about the black experience, but not having that get pigeonholed into it has to be only funny or it has to be only serious. And those were things that were in my head as I was doing this comic, because I didn't feel pressure to make it one thing. Like, in the comic book format, like, lends itself to sometimes being tongue-in-cheek and sometimes being serious and sometimes having action and like all that. It felt, you know, even though I'd never done this before, it weirdly felt kind of normal and natural.
Is Casper Cole liberating as a project, as a character?
Yeah, I mean, it was like, there were some parallels where I was like, I know how to kind of write this character. It's like, the only thing they told me is like, they gave me like where the character needed to begin, and they told me where the character needed to end. And outside of that, I kind of had free rein to tell a story and kind of develop his, you know, kind of his swagger and like how he talked to people. And like, one thing about this character is that he lived in New York and had bouts of financial trouble and was often broke, but he's trying to overcome this, and he has back and forth issues with authority and wants mentors. And so I was like, I know what this is, and I felt like this character before. So it was liberating to be able to write like that, but also have him be, you know, have superhero abilities.
Sometimes the comic book world is criticized for doing the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. Is what you're doing actually moving the whole industry into a new world, a new dimension, a new set of stories?
What I do think is interesting is kind of what's happened the past 2 years, where you're getting, you know, a person like Ta-Nehisi Coates, a person like Roxane Gay, myself, people that came from one traditional world, a world of journalism that gave a lot of black writers a platform to tell all different types of stories. Like, I think it is interesting. Like, I wouldn't have done this if it wasn't for the two of them.
Right.
And seeing not only them have some success, but it being kind of this freeing project to go in a completely different direction that people are like, wait, why are they doing comics? But when you really think about it, it makes sense, because it's just storytelling in another form. You know, I'm interested to see what directions things go, but I do think, like, at the most basic level, I think it's very cool that people like us are getting an opportunity to, you know, really step outside of our comfort zone and be educated in comics, but also be embraced by having our voice and putting it in this medium.
Well, Rembert Brown, thanks so much.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
That's Rembert Brown in conversation with John Hockenberry there. Rembert Brown is a journalist and co-author of Black Panther, World of Wakanda number 6, The Return of Casper Cole, which comes out today.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on black Americans from colonial times to the present.
An HBO film out this weekend works to expose a historic injustice. The movie is based on a best-selling book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It's a true story, in which the title character is played by Oprah Winfrey in her first leading role in a TV movie since the 1990s. Here's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans.
HBO's The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks begins with a brilliant montage showing the birth of the biomedical industry. Researchers in the 1950s took cancer cells from a young black woman, which led to the development of drugs for polio, leukemia, and many other illnesses.
What makes this sample so unique is that this is the first cell line we have discovered in over 30 years of trying that can survive and reproduce indefinitely.
But Lax's family wasn't told back then that the cells were taken or compensated for them. Lax's daughter, Deborah, played in the film by Oprah Winfrey, was particularly wounded by the secrecy.
For years, it seemed like a dream, not knowing what was going on, not knowing who to go to for understanding, didn't even know how to talk about it.
Deborah Lax is a role that Winfrey seems destined to play. She was a passionate, righteous woman struggling against racism and a tangled family history to learn more about the mother who died when she was a child. So when journalist Rebecca Skloot calls, hoping to write a book about Henrietta, Deborah is jubilant.
Hallelujah! Old folks, they didn't talk about it. Nobody wasn't alive. So my whole life I grew up not knowing one thing, not even the littlest things, like what was her favorite color, or what happened to her clothes? You better get yourself ready, because this story is crazy enough for three books.
Winfrey's down-to-earth charm helps humanize Deborah, who had serious mood swings. The movie's largely told from the journalist's point of view, and the real-life Skloot told me last week that Deborah, who died in 2009, wanted Winfrey to play her in any movie.
She always said, you know, this book is going to come out, it's going to be a bestseller, Oprah's going to make a movie, and she's going to play me. Like, she was just sure of it, and I just felt the story would be safe with her.
Skloot and Deborah Lax spent years working on the book. They had to pull information from an indifferent, white-dominated medical establishment, which included people who took blood from the Lax family for further research, letting them believe they were testing them for cancer. In the film, Skloot, played by actress Rose Byrne, confronts a doctor who was involved.
Were you aware that the Laxes thought that you were testing them for cancer?
I suspect there was no effort to explain anything in great detail. It's not like those people would have understood anyway.
Fans of the book will notice there isn't as much science in the movie. Director George C. Wolfe said he chose to make the film's story more personal.
The film needed to be about Deborah. Not all of us have cells that have transformed modern medicine, but we all want to know our parents more.
The movie's impending debut has also exposed tensions among some in the Lax family. Henrietta's oldest child, Lawrence Lax, and his son Ron criticized both the book and the film publicly last month. They've now scaled back their comments, saying they're more concerned about the accuracy of the book. Skloot and her publisher have stood by the book's accuracy. HBO, in a statement, said filmmakers worked with five other Lax family members as paid consultants. In the end, HBO's The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lax is uneven. It has deeply affecting moments, but they don't quite knit together into a consistently powerful film. But it does succeed by showcasing Winfrey in one of her best roles yet, playing a complicated woman willing to face down any obstacle to bring her mother's truth to the world. I'm Eric Deggan.
I got Krenag, yeah, I got Krenag. Got that Krenag, yeah, I got Krenag. Started from the trap, now I rap. No matter where I'm at, I got crack.
And what may be the single largest dismissal of wrongful convictions in U.S. history, Massachusetts prosecutors announced Tuesday they're going to throw out 21,587 criminal drug cases. The cases were all prosecuted based on evidence or testimony supplied by a former state chemist who admitted to faking tests and identifying evidence as illegal narcotics without even testing the evidence. The chemist, named Annie Ducan, pleaded guilty in 2013 to tampering with evidence during her 9 years working at a state crime lab in Boston. During that time, thousands of people were convicted based on her false statements. Tuesday's announcement is a major win for civil liberties attorneys and public defenders who spent years in litigation fighting to have these drug cases dismissed. Many of the so-called Ducan defendants have completed lengthy prison sentences and continue to suffer the consequences of being convicted of a drug offense, from not being able to get jobs to already being deported. Well, for more, we're joined by three guests. Matt Siegel is with us in D.C. He's the legal director of the ACLU of Massachusetts. Mallory Honora is a member of the Boston-based group Families for Justice as Healing, which has been advocating for those wrongfully convicted as a result of tainted evidence handled in the scandal. And Timothy Taylor also joins us from Massachusetts. He was arrested in 2009, served 5 years in prison on a drug trafficking charge. Annie Duquesne is on record as having handled evidence in his case. Taylor's asked for it to be reopened. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Matt Siegel, first talk about the breadth, the scope of this case. This is historic. Over 21,000 cases. What's happening to them?
Well, you're right, Amy, and thank you for having me. It is historic. We think it is going to be, when all is said and done, the single largest dismissal of cases in U.S. history. And it's because this misconduct was allowed to go on for so many years. And as a consequence of that, people have already served their sentences and have been living with the collateral consequences of those sentences. So what we hope will happen as a result of these dismissals is that it will allow people like your guest, Timothy, to move on with their lives, to rebuild their lives, and to move on from these convictions.
So give us the history of what took place, Matt. Talk about this one tester in Massachusetts and what this led to. How many years she worked there, and are there others involved?
Well, she worked there for around 8 years. And unfortunately, it takes a village to taint 21,000 cases. And although she was probably the only person who was intentionally falsifying evidence, there were a lot of missteps along the way. She was caught red-handed in June 2011. Her misconduct wasn't disclosed to the public until August 2012. And even then, prosecutors didn't step forward to voluntarily vacate these convictions. Instead, it took years of litigation by the public defenders, by pro bono lawyers, and by the ACLU to get to this point now, where prosecutors, having lost in court at the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court in January, are agreeing to these dismissals. So it was, unfortunately, a really long and difficult process. But what we're hoping comes out of it is a roadmap for dealing with these kinds of scandals, both in Massachusetts and throughout the country.
Now, explain again, what is the deal that was worked out? Originally, you had the state prosecutors pushing for individual reconsideration of Duquesne's cases rather than a mass resolution. But right. What ultimately, how was it resolved?
Well, so I mentioned the roadmap, and I think the thing that really flipped the switch and made these dismissals possible was putting the burden on prosecutors to come forward to say which cases that they think should be dismissed and which cases they think they could keep using untainted evidence. And that's crucial, because when the state wrongfully convicts people, it should be up to the state to say how it's going to fix that problem, instead of requiring individual people by the thousands to come forward and litigate case by case. So what happened in this litigation was our state's highest court put that burden on the prosecutors to come forward and to do so in 90 days from the court's decision to identify cases to dismiss. And that flipping of the burden really opened the doors to a more just outcome. And in addition, what we're going to see going forward is a process of giving robust and real notice to the people who are wrongfully convicted, so that they can take advantage of these dismissals and help to rebuild their lives.
How was Annie Duquesne caught, this chemist at the Hinton Drug Lab? How was she caught falsifying evidence? I mean, the number of people that she has been responsible for putting away.
Yes. Well, she was caught essentially several times, because people kept coming reportedly to supervisors at the lab expressing concerns that she was doing a superhumanly high volume of testing. And it turns out that's because she was inventing the test results. But eventually, the final disclosure that allowed the public to eventually learn about this was when there was a transfer in who was running the lab where she worked. And she was actually interviewed by the state police and essentially confessed to all manner of of wrongdoing, and this was in 2012. And what had happened before then is that potential whistleblowers, people who came to lab managers to express concerns about their colleague, Andy Dukin, were told things like, well, this is being handled as a personnel matter, when in fact it wasn't. So what we had was the silencing, really, of whistleblowers, of potential whistleblowers, and then followed by a state police investigation, which revealed this to the public in 2012.
And what about another lab worker at another lab, at the Amherst lab, Sonia Farak, what she did?
Well, this was a lab worker who was actually herself suffering from addiction and was taking drugs and using drugs and even manufacturing drugs at the lab where she worked. And that she too has been prosecuted, but there again, we haven't seen resolution, and this is something that the ACLU and defense lawyers all across Massachusetts are working on, and that's why it's sort of crucial that what we hope comes out of this is not only justice for the defendants who've been harmed, but a roadmap for fixing these scandals without allowing them to linger on for years. Because the one thing we know about treating the problem of drug addiction or drug use as a criminal justice issue and not as a public health issue is that these kinds of scandals of wrongful convictions are going to be inevitable.
Mallory Honora, you are with Families for Justice as Healing. Talk about,
yes,
first your response to the vacating of these cases, the dismissal of the more than 21,000 drug cases, and how your organization was involved.
I'm experiencing happiness when we win a victory for the people. I think that people have been waiting a long time to experience any amount of relief and validation for the burden that they've experienced with these wrongful convictions. And the mission of Families for Justice as Healing is to end the incarceration of women and girls. And also, as women in the community, we experience harm when our loved ones go to prison and we're dealing with our loved ones who aren't with us. For us, we see this as a systemic issue, and moving forward, we're continuing to organize because I agree with Matt that this type of abuse of power and misconduct is inevitable when we're prosecuting so many thousands and thousands of people every year. And instead of doing this, we need healing, housing, and treatment. We don't need to be railroading more thousands of people into the criminal punishment system.
I have parents who don't like white people.
Let black people go to reparations.
A man suspected in a deadly shooting spree in Fresno shouted out in court today. A judge then quickly postponed arraignment for Corey Ali Mohammed and ordered him to undergo a mental evaluation. Action News reporter Gene Hagenson joins us now live from the Fresno County Courthouse with a look at the next legal steps. Gene?
That's right, Warren. Corey Mohammed was scheduled to be arraigned for the murder of Carl Williams, a Motel 6 security guard, and the attempted murder of another guard. However, after he shouted out in court, the judge agreed that the hearing should be delayed while his mental competency was tested. Corey Ali Mohammed was brought into court in a yellow jumpsuit, but his attorney argued the media should not be allowed to show him. The prosecutor agreed, saying showing him in a jail jumpsuit could prejudice a jury, so no pictures of Mohammed were allowed in court. But you can hear him shout out as the proceedings got underway.
We're in session, People versus Corey Ali Mohammed, state appearance.
Public defender Eric Christensen was appointed to represent Mohammed, but immediately asked for the arraignment to be delayed.
I believe this gentleman may not be mentally competent to proceed.
That's when Mohammed shouted out.
Let black people go at reparation.
Mohammed was referring to the movement to pay reparations to African Americans for past injustices. Judge Kent Hamlin then went on.
You feel he's unable to understand the proceedings or assist counsel in his defense? At the present time, yes. Proceedings are suspended under 1368 of the Penal Code.
A psychiatrist was appointed to evaluate Mohammed, and he is scheduled to return to court on May 12th. Criminologist Dr. Eric Hickey says the evaluation will figure out if Mohammed is competent or faking it.
In court today, he was acting out a bit, saying off-the-wall things,
Was this malingering, or was this something that he truly has some mental illness? Is he delusional? Is he hearing voices? So these things will be determined as he goes through some form of psychological evaluation.
District Attorney Lisa Smitkamp was in the courtroom but was not willing to comment on the case because other charges against Muhammad in the shooting deaths of three other men are still pending. And as you heard, the charges in the deaths of the three men killed this week have not been filed. Now, Muhammad is alleged to have killed the security guard, Carl Williams, and then went on to shoot the other three men because he didn't want to be known for killing a Hispanic security guard. That was Williams. He wanted to be known for killing three white men. Reporting live from the Fresno County Courthouse, Gene Hagenson, ABC 30 Action News.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, April 22nd, 2017. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have observations, thoughts, suggestions, some of the audio clips that we heard. Certainly there were other news relevant events that took place over the last week. The French presidential election is this weekend as well. Dial in with your thoughts. The number 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. A couple quick things before we get to the callers. I had horrendous Wi-Fi connection last week for the Global Sunday broadcast, or at least the attempt. It did not work out at all, and I just said, forget it, we will try again tomorrow. So we will do that again, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon tomorrow. That would be Sunday. We'll be right on time for the French presidential election. I doubt things will have wrapped up to see how all that plays out, but at least we can look at the preliminaries from that tomorrow, as well as what's gone down since our last Global Sunday talk. Tomorrow, item one. Number two, listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported, invested in the cows 8+ years. I hope the broadcast continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Two things from the audio segments, and then we'll get to folks who dialed in. The first up, those last two news segments, the suspected or the reported shooting that took place in Fresno, California, where the three whites were killed by a black male, allegedly, and the thousands, tens of thousands of cases that were thrown out in Massachusetts after whites and their bogus science, even though I think the female that they are pinning this on and saying, you know, she did all this. I think she might be classified as a non-white person, but as was pointed out in the Democracy Now! Piece, it takes a village to engage in these types of crimes. And I am sure the folks that are in charge directly, indirectly of that village of corruption are white. But those two segments, and again, I want to make sure I get in as well. If folks remember a couple years back, the FBI, when they conceded that their lab, too, had been producing all these bogus results, and this wasn't like five cases, this was bunches of them. And most of them had been for the prosecution where they conceded, yep, we got a whole lot of data that was totally bogus, where somebody went in and, oh, yeah, I'm official. I got all my degrees in science and chemistry and everything else. And, oh, yeah, we got our DNA and hair evidence and all this. And he did it. Oh, yeah, he's guilty. And then, nope, we just went in and gave some total nonsense and some people probably got convicted. Whoops, just to put it in context. But to have this happen. And they said all these, some people already did their sentence and, you know, now having trouble getting a job and just moving forward with their life. To have that sort of thing happen, it is amazing that you do not have. And I'm not even saying that the situation in Fresno, that's just what's been reported. I don't know what's true or not. I try to say it in that way consistently, that this is what's been reported, that this is an alleged shooting, to say it in that manner. I don't, just from what's reported, it's amazing that you don't have more instances of that where black people, because of the terrorism that we're being subjected to, even if we don't know that whites are doing all of these things to cause us problems and to make our life as difficult as they possibly can, to reach that point where you just can't take it anymore and then get into counter violence or whatever to deal with whites. It's amazing that you don't have more instances of that. I think a lot of times our self-destructive behavior, we just end up directing our frustrations at other victims. The other thing I wanted to get in, this week I was having a conversation, disagreement with another non-white person. Thankfully, it remained courteous. There was no biting, no throwing of coffee, no cursing, remained amicable. Once things got resolved, I said, you know, I'm going to take a stroll, go out. There's a body of water near my current house, and I'm talking out loud to myself as I'm thinking, and it's late for con. It's like we'll call it 2 a.m. So I said, I'm going to go to the body of water, but I'm not sure. And I'm talking to a non-black male. And I said, I think I'm going to go to the water. I'm not sure. And I paused because this individual had just told me that about literally a block from where this water is, he had been practicing lacrosse outside at like 6 a.m. This was in the last 30 days. And about four enforcement officials rolled up on him. It ended up being a long 30-minute ordeal. Who are you? Where have you been going? Do you know bin Laden? Blah, blah, blah. They let him go finally. But I mean, who wants, you know, 30-minute encounter with four armed race soldiers at the crack of dawn? So I had that on my mind, and I had just, you know, I've been here, I've been looking around, I try to be vigilant in places where I am going to be, and I had seen, it seems that the enforcement officials patrol this area pretty regularly, particularly once the sun goes down. You'll see a lot of their presence in the area, even though it doesn't strike me as a dangerous, you know, neighborhood. So I, you know, kind of raised some concern about whether or not this is a smart move to go out at this hour and could potentially run into a Daniel Holdsclaw. And my friend, he says, you know, hey, I don't think it'll be a problem. They stopped me. I was next to the building. It was actually someone inside, and he might have just called the police to say, yeah, there's someone trespassing. I think just walking down to the water, I think it'll be fine. And he ends, he says, you know, you can't live your life in fear. You can't just sit and be stuffed in the house all the time, you know, and not do anything. We have a difference of opinion on white supremacy. He's one of the people who kind of takes the view that the way that I present about white supremacy at times just makes it seem very depressing and makes it seem like, you know, you just don't want to go outside and enjoy yourself, that type of thing. You're just making it seem, oh, so bad, like they just have so much power. And so, you know, I listened and I said, I think I'm going to go to the river for maybe just a minute or two. And so I go outside, been walking maybe 5 minutes. I can just see the water. And I said, you know, it's not just the police. Same thing I tell to you all on the program regularly. White people are dangerous, badge or no. And I said, man, all that talk that they've been doing about white people on drugs, I think Thomas in New York has said that before. Roz, some of you all have pointed that out explicitly. You got all of these drugged up white people. They are just as dangerous, if not more, than race soldiers. And I said, man, I am going back to the house. Forget it. I can go to, I can go check out the water tomorrow. I can do this once the sun is up. I feel like that'll be a much less risky proposition. So I turn around, to go back to the house, I'm, let's estimate, maybe 50 meters, 50 yards from the house. I can literally see the rooftop. So I'm walking back. I kid you not, enforcement officer rolls by. And I see them. I just start cracking up laughing. Now, my friend, I'm not sure if he would have thought that, you know, that is reason to not go. Just an enforcement official rolling by, is that reason enough to stay in the house if it's late at night? The whole reason that I thought to share this and my concluding thoughts about all of this, at the end of the day, either we have a system of racism, white supremacy, or we do not. If we do, obviously, which position I've taken, if we do, then I do think you just want to make logical choices based on the environment that we're in. That's all this really comes down to. Does that make sense? If you get information, hey, there's going to be a hurricane in the area, what do I do with that information? Is that the time to plan a yachting trip? Is that the time to go be out on the lake? Or do I say, well, wait a minute, I'm going to take some precautions. They have reported that there might be a hurricane. I'm going to wait. Let's see how the weather looks. And then we can plan accordingly. I've seen a lot of evidence. I think Dr. Cambon, he has stated this unambiguously. Black people should not be out and about after 11 p.m. I'm not saying you got to be a coward. I'm not saying that you have to live your entire life in fear. I'm just saying from my observation, and I think this was the same spirit that Dr. Cambon operated with, a lot of these encounters with race soldiers, it seems that a good chunk of these happen after it's dark. It, at least to me, it seems like enforcement officers, the Daniel Holtzclaws of the world, it seems like they tend to get a lot more latitude, a lot more discretion once the sun goes down, when they can say, oh man, I couldn't see what he had. It looked like he had a bulge in his pocket. I didn't know that stick of gum wasn't an Uzi. I mean, it seems like they get a lot more latitude for that type of foolishness, to make up those type of lies, to kill black people. I couldn't see him, or he fit the description. I couldn't really see in the light so well, so he looked like that nigger that robbed the 7-Eleven last week, but it turns out that this is a 10-year-old boy. They get a lot more latitude for that sort of thing once the sun goes down. And at least it seems to be my conclusion. Once it's dark, I'd say especially after like 11, like late dark, like, oh man, what are you doing out here, nigga? It doesn't matter what type of car you have. Doesn't matter if you're on foot. Doesn't matter if you're in a vehicle, at the grocery store, trying to run to get medication for your child, anything. Once it's that hour, it seems like there are a good chunk of white people, you are suspicious automatically. I think that's why Dr. Cambon recommends it. And I think that's why I say, hey, you know, I go out. Yes, I go outside late in the evening. Yes, I've done that. But I do even try to be codified about that. Just because I know things can go bad very, very quickly. And I know for myself, I've had a number of instances where I've been stopped by enforcement officials literally a block or less from my residence. When I lived in California, in a 6-month period of time, I got stopped by enforcement officers 3 different times within a block and a half of my residence, and every time it was at night. And it wasn't even late. Some of these were like 6 p.m. Sun had just went down. Some were like 9 p.m. Very reasonable hours, and I was still a suspicious Bay Area Negro. So all of that just to say, I'm not encouraging or telling anyone to be a coward with my views on racism, white supremacy. I don't think that's what codification is about. I just think it is very crucially important for black people just to keep that in mind. This is not justice. We're not on a planet where black people are encouraged and loved and respected. That's not where we are. It would be great. Yes, go outside anytime you feel like it. Do whatever you want. Have a great time. Just go out. You don't have to think about any of that. We have enemies. War is being waged against us. I'm very sorry that that is the case, but that has a big impact. In my view, it should have a big impact on how we think, how we speak, how we behave, our feelings, everything in terms of our behavior under these conditions, because it's been my observation. We make a lot of errors when we forget that, when we minimize that, when we act like that's not so. That's when we end up just having tons of problems. And I feel I would be remiss if I minimized that this was a non-white, non-black person saying this. And I remember when I first heard that, he went outside at a late or kooky hour, 6 a.m., and got stopped and detained for 30 minutes by 4 enforcement officials. I thought, as did others who heard this incident, oh man, if he had been black, woof, that could have been way worse. I don't know if that's his opinion. Maybe he would agree, maybe he wouldn't, but that is certainly my opinion. And I just think all of that is important information to keep in mind. We're in a system of racism, white supremacy. We need to be codified at all times. I can easily go to the lake when the sun is out. With that, we'll get to our callers. The number again is 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. I was chuckling also because I thought I would be so embarrassed if I had gotten like mauled or tased or beaten by enforcement officials and somehow I survived it. And then I had to come back on the cows and explain that, yes, I was out at 2 a.m. and go take a stroll by the lake and got mauled by enforcement officials. I know people would be saying, what in the world were you doing out there? Anyway, you were telling us that anytime. I thought that would have been super embarrassing. So I'm glad nothing happened. And yeah, that is not something I encourage. That's it for the program. As usual, if we could not use metaphors today, this is the only program I make that request, the compensatory call in on Saturdays. It's been my experience. It happened today. As a matter of fact, victim of racism, Charles Barkley was using, he made an analogy and he got called out on air specifically. What kind of crazy analogy is that? What are you even talking about? This happens all the time, particularly with whites. When people talk about racism, they present the most absurd, inaccurate comparisons. They will consistently just any two things, any two concepts, any two events, and say that these things are related or similar, and they will be completely different. In my view, racists do this a lot to practice racism. Non-white people like Mr. Barkley, myself, we're victims of racism. We pick up a lot of racists' characteristics. They model a lot of bad behavior, and a lot of us, we're still learning. We just haven't come to conclusions. We're getting more information, and in trying to articulate ourselves, sometimes we just rely on metaphors to articulate our thoughts. Sometimes it does not work out well at all and just ends up conveying more confusion, and we're just not saying things that are accurate. So if we could just work to be explicit, direct, right, explicit, direct, and clear about what it is we want to say, and not employ metaphors. I'll prompt about this and make an effort to not use metaphors and analogies on this program this evening myself. With that, if we could take about 5 minutes, share whatever thoughts, observations you have, I'll prompt. That way everybody gets an opportunity to share once everyone has spoken once. Then we'll have time if you have additional comments or questions or anything else you want to add. We'll get that in as well. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. In fact, and I'll even give out the number one more time. 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Now, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. If you have commentary, feel free. Was that someone speaking? I didn't know if that was an echo or if someone was speaking.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I wasn't expecting to be the first one, but might as well go ahead on. Well, I'll just mention about the quote-unquote mentoring program that I've been a part of. We just finished a second cycle sessions with the second group of young black males. Today, it ended with dressing up, so to speak, quote unquote, and going to a restaurant, which to me is like an act of humility, to understand and realize that for a lot of the more comfortable amenities that non-white black people would be able to benefit from, we have to, in this case of males, put on a suit and tie and basically, like Mr. Fuller says, beg for that opportunity, which is far more better than stealing and robbing people for those things. So basically, that's how I look at it. But I went ahead and done it because of the reality of it all, and I committed to the program itself. But one of the dynamic things about the program is that each quote-unquote mentor, and I keep using the word quote-unquote mentor because, as Mr. Fuller says, there's actually if no one who can function as a quote-unquote mentor under the system of racist white supremacy because of how we have been collectively rendered. But nevertheless, I do know the importance of being in a company of other non-white black people under the context of saying and doing things constructive, and this program certainly does fit that mode. And you get to share any and everything that is constructive and can assist these young black males to the point to whereas they have a better means to organize their own thoughts, their own speech and actions. So I am very grateful to be able to be a part of this. Probably since I've been doing it so long, primarily in the place of coaching football, this is probably I'll be doing it on the day that the retired firefighter passes on or distinguishes. I'll probably be doing something like this. But it's, you know, a very grateful thing that I'm allowed to be able to do. And just wanted to mention that to everybody. And that's all I have for right now. Thank you.
I thought of retired firefighter when I heard that clip. Now, different sport, obviously, in the sound clip. They were talking about getting black children to play baseball in Chicago, but sounded very similar to retired firefighter's efforts. Other folks that we have not heard from, other folks that dialed in that we have not heard from who have a hand up, make sure folks are not spectating. Other folks that dialed in that we have not heard from, feel free. Yes, ma'am.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for taking my call. Just to be really quick, this black female caller from Ohio. I have been kind of speaking to my family a little bit more about racism, white supremacy, and in some parts it has been going a little bit better. Like, for instance, my mom this week, she had decided to get her car washed at a black-owned car wash, and she was very, you know, pleased with the service. So that kind of made me happy. Another thing that she had told me, because she actually does, like, the driving service, like, she's not a taxi, but she does that whole thing, and she was telling me about a conversation that she had with a passenger, another black female, and she was telling her about how my mother was telling the black female how when she lived in Minnesota, she would go to stores and white people would just cut in front of her in line. And at first, my mother, of course, being confused, just like how we all are, I'm definitely dealing with my own confusion, but she wouldn't think anything of it. She would think, oh, well, these are older people, or they probably didn't see her or whatever. But that was probably like the first couple of times. And then, you know, after so long, she's like, no, this is just basically a subtle way of them, you know, practicing racism. And I didn't even know that. It's like, you know, they practice, right, whites practice racism so subtly. And it goes far beyond, you know, just name calling or whatever. Another thing that I just want to kind of share quickly, and I'll share more on Thursday when we do the workplace racism. I'm also the one who said that my boss had passed. Well, they did like a whole little like ceremony for him basically at my job. And I asked a fellow victim that I used to speak to a lot. And I kind of felt that it was weird that this was happening, that, you know, they're spending so much time on, you know, celebrating, you know, him and everything. And I asked him, like, you know, the victim, a non-white male, I'm like, has this ever happened before? He was like, well, he had a couple of shades on the other people, but these are his words. I'm not trying to use a metaphor. And it's just really surprising to me that it seems like sometimes when you think people are confused, they do display some level of, I guess, consciousness. That's all I wanted to share. Thank you for taking my call.
Very interesting. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you dialed in and have a hand up, lines should be open. Loving it when we have lots of people that dialed in with a hand up and everyone is being quiet. Love it. Love it. The other folks who dialed in more recently with a hand up, line should be open as well.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. And greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. I wanted to just give some of my thoughts on the clips and also on just racism in general. I would say we need to study psychology. And I would say that's one of the major things that the people who classify as white, they have over us. They have psychology. They understand psychology very well. And a bit of workplace racism. I had a closing Friday, and a real estate closing. I'm a real estate agent or a real estate broker. And anyway, the closing attorney said to my buyer during the closing, she used a metaphor, and the metaphor didn't make any sense. During the closing, my buyer said that she's a teacher. And then the other buyer said, well, she's a substitute. You know, they're a substitute teacher. That person's a substitute teacher. And what the closing attorney said was that, said something to the buyer about being a teacher, you know, oh, that's brave, you're brave. And then she said to the other buyer, who was the substitute teacher, oh, you're very brave. That's like a drive-by shooting. And I'm, you know, I didn't say anything, but I'm thinking, no, that's not anything like a drive-by shooting. But that was a bit of psychology that she was using. Even, you know, it didn't make any sense, but it was something that you could say was racial, you know, because black people have to deal with drive-by shootings so often. So that she just made that metaphor to do a damage to your psychology or to my buyer's psychology. So I had to try to address that after, we got out of that closing. The other things I wanted to say quickly was that, when the clip about the natives being moved from one piece of land to another piece of land, that piece of land where they decided to move there because it was rocky. They thought, you know, perhaps white people will leave us alone if we go over here. And then the white people were able to kill them, or the people who classify as white were able to kill the blacks or the Native Americans, even on that, on this other rocky piece of land. You know, and the way that the people who classify as white were able to do the killings was because somebody in the family got close with the enemy, with the people who have invaded. You know, these are absolute enemies. And somebody, just like what happens often in my family, somebody is sleeping with one of the enemy, and something happens in the family. Something really bad happens in the family. So, you know, you have to seriously be careful about that type of stuff. And, you know, don't befriend them. And also systems, all systems function correct. All systems function. Even if it seems like it's just, you know, like you think it might be a silly system, like perhaps, you know, you might say, well, this system of white supremacy is put together, you know, real stupid. You know, it's just a stupid system. Well, all systems still work. You know, so it still functions. So you have to figure out how this functions so that you can take it apart or you can completely eradicate it. We don't want this ever again. This white supremacy stuff, the invasion, the genocide of black people, we don't want this stuff. And they're going to try to overwhelm us. They're overwhelming us already, but they're going to try to overwhelm us in more soon times. And sometime soon, they're going to try to overwhelm us, and we have to be careful, or we have to be prepared, and we have to stop it, because we can, you know, since we know things are going to come, we can figure out, we can predict what's going to come, and we can stop it. You know, so we'd have to figure out how do we stop whichever way they're going to come at us, and they're going to come at us in every way. We're going to have to be able to defend ourselves in every way. But that also means if we're defending ourselves in every way possible, that means you really, really can't be with them. You really, really can't be with white people or the people who classify as white. And I've been trying to figure out another name for them, you know, something real, real powerful that I could just, you know, call them. And every time, and I feel some type of emotion or something, but I, you know, I can't even figure out what to call them. But you know, whatever. And the last things that I would say is that the female caller before me was talking about she's been speaking to her family more often about racism, white supremacy, you know, and that's what we should all be doing. I would say something constructive you can do with your family, and a time that you can devote to a constructive activity, I would say would be getting with your family and making a chart of relatives, and however you chart it out, there are certain charts. Some are called family trees, but that could be a metaphor, but that's the name of certain charts. But make a chart, and that way you'll be spending time with each other, and I think that might be a good time to bring up some counter-racist concepts. That's all. Oh, I would also say, I would pose to everybody, you know, something I heard on one of the previous Cal's clips, context of racism, white supremacy. The question was, how will you feel once racism, white supremacy is eliminated? And I asked that question, how will you feel once racism, white supremacy is eradicated? I know I'll feel very relieved. I would be very happy, and that's what I want. That's what we want. Thank you.
Hear, hear, Ashe. That clip on the white terrorists, what they did in Oklahoma, the non-white people that relocated there purposely, in the hopes that whites would leave them alone, and then the whites just came. They married into the family, killed them off, and stole their oil. Wow. Like, that it definitely is one to file it, that audio segment. File that. Remember where it is. If you need to bookmark it or wherever it is. Insert that. Conversations about sexual intercourse between white people and non-white people might be a reference point for why it is so dangerous. other folks that we have not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, mine should be open.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Good evening, everyone. Good show, as usual, good clips. I guess first thing I think I heard was the hiking. One thing I'm surprised that maybe I wasn't listening carefully enough, I didn't hear about the cost of hiking. You know, that is it's a healthy activity that needs to be done, but that is a leisure activity. And to do it properly, I think it takes a great amount of cost to go to these national parks, hike these big trails. And I'm surprised that wasn't brought up in how most Black people don't have the resources to do that type of activity. They may be able to go fishing, because at least with fishing, you can get the food and eat it. You know, you can have fun and eat. So I was surprised that wasn't brought up. There was a clip with the man who was doing the comic, and at the end, he was asked a question, and he didn't give a clear answer. And I thought, well, I guess that's kind of what happens when you keep doing things with or for white people, because a lot of times you'll ask white people a direct question and they don't give an answer either. I think he asked him about, does his work move diversity forward or something like that. And he didn't really give a clear answer to that. I don't know if anyone noticed that. And then the clip where the white lady was like, oh, I see how you feel. I need to go take a walk. I can't take this. I don't know. Whatever her little thing was. You know, I felt uneasy because she said she went to the Black lady's house. I was like, oh, Black lady, oh, poor thing. You have to get your house fumigated now. Oh, no, poor lady. And what's more important in that conversation, they never talked about what are we going to do to end racism. I don't need to get to know you. I know a lot of Black people. I know a lot of white people. I know a lot of different types of people. Maybe that's just me. If we're not going to be constructive, I mean, you should just say hi and bye, and I don't think they got the point of that. The legal issue in Massachusetts, I hope those people file a suit and just take over the state of Massachusetts because it's owed to them. And I can't think of anything else right now. Thank you.
Appreciate that. I know one of our listeners in the great VA always makes that point that a lot of times racists, they'll talk about racism as though this is like a personal problem. The problem is that we just don't know each other. So we need to just sit down and have tea or visit each other's houses or meet at Starbucks. And if we just do that enough times, then this problem will be solved. And our VA listener, she always points that out and said, it's absolutely absurd. And what are you saying, that I got to go to every individual that's classified as white? I got to go to their house or meet them? That's how we're going to solve. I mean, it's just absolutely absurd to even think that way. Other folks that we have not heard from.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. And I believe on the part of the audio segment where I think they were talking about, I believe it was two young Black people that were showing their school experiences. And I think it may have been a parent that was talking to one of them. And I believe that was the female child that was saying how she didn't really like discussing things that I guess she had experienced or something. And just the tone of the voice, it sounded like she was in so much misery and depression, you know, and rightfully, understandably so, under these conditions. And I think it really can just really have an effect on the mental health of victims. And I can't really remember what the male was saying. It seemed like he was, like, I guess I could say more optimistic or more expecting of the behavior of the suspected racist. And, you know, he was more, I guess, open and expressive about his experiences. And the female child, you know, I guess is going to have to take more, I guess, more patience to get more of her experiences. And it just goes to show you, like when you play that audio segment, I think it was former President Obama, how, you know, it's very powerful how you add that audio segment before these, you know, fresh and new stories that still shows that it's quite the opposite. And, you know, I think that's very, very artistic and very powerful to have that audio clip there. And as far as the comics, like I did some research on that. Like when they said they were, I guess, using diversity, they were trying to make, I guess, new versions of Spider-Man or whatever. Like what I've noticed is that they've taken a lot of their popular characters and they've made like non-white versions of them, like a Hawkeye or Incredible Hulk, Captain America. And apparently the, I guess, female version of Captain America is a non-white, I guess what they call a Latina or whatever. And she likes females. She's a lesbian. You know, that's just one basic description of I guess what they're trying to do. And they did that with Iron Man. They made it a younger black female. And I guess that just goes with that pun. They like when they like to call us minorities, they made them into children, basically, or teenagers. They made them teenagers, you know, like not adults. They made them into that version to say that they are supporting diversity. So I think that's very just interesting how they portrayed it like that and, you know, have it remain with the white heroes being the adults, you know, the ones that they make the movies off of, and they just use those non-white versions and they just call them minors and minorities. And that's all I can think of now, and thanks for allowing me to speak.
Appreciate that. Yeah, the young people, I think, is really important. I don't, the segment, the StoryCorps segment where it was black father talking to his black daughter about their experiences in the classroom, and, you know, she said she had been called a nigger and blah, blah, blah. I did get that impression as well, that he was, I guess, more hopeful about things. And I think it's real important for us to keep that in mind. These young white people, they're not ignorant. And even, in fact, the clip after that where it was a white, suspected racist white female child saying that she was being bullied because she was dating black males. And I thought that was important because they didn't say she had a black boyfriend. They said she was dating black males. So you already got a serial predator, in my opinion. But even in that segment, I thought it was important because it was portraying her as, oh, the victim and all they're doing, and we're going to get out there and stop this. And I can't believe it. And number one, it sounded like it was her other white pals who were doing it. So, I mean, you still got little terrorists. She looked like she was in middle school, so we were talking probably, what, 13, 14 years old. They're not ignorant. And even her, that's an act of... I will leave Area 8 alone, but I thought that clip was real important. I don't know if that stood out in the audio because you couldn't see it, but that was a white, suspected racist white female child alleging that she was being bullied by her white classmates. They didn't identify them as such because she dates black boys, plural, at her school. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have not dialed in, or if you haven't spoken, sorry, feel free. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Greetings to everyone on the line. I did have a couple of comments from the clips. The clip on the black female hiker, I thought that was another crystal clear example of how we do this in a system of white supremacy. Something so basic as just walking, so basic to existence, is affected by being classified as non-white. I thought it was interesting how they kept saying it was considered an oddity because a lot of African Americans, as they said, don't hike, or I guess there's not statistics of them hiking. I thought that that's exactly what she stated, that you know, the reason for that is racism, the history of racism in this particular area of the world, fear of safety in woods, everything. She had a pretty clear understanding of that. In the clip on the Osage Indians, I'm going to definitely have to check out that book because I thought it was about the whole, quote, white guardian being assigned to aid them in spending the money or using the money that they had earned from the oil or gotten for the oil. Was really interesting, and then to put that in the that word, white guardian, keep that in the context of how this white male married a non-white female just to kill everyone in her family to take the money. But yeah, and sorry, I think it was gave my last minutes on the clips, but something that you stated earlier, I guess, about, you know, the fallacy and thinking that the end of the system of white supremacy would be everyone basically getting along and knowing each other and being cool with each other. Yeah, I think that is a huge fallacy. I believe I asked that to a previous guest before. It's like, do I have to know every single white person for me to no longer be mistreated? And I think she said something to the effect of, no, it's not on you. Okay, so then just every single white person has to get to know me for me to no longer be mistreated. Like, it's just that is stupid. And I am very simple minded, but that's what that comes down to when people say, oh, we just need to get to know each other. Do I have to know every single person, every single white person on the face of this planet to not be mistreated anymore? That's ridiculous. So, but anyway, that's all I have for right now. I'll meet my wife.
Indeed. Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Awesome. This is Ken Steele. I am currently in Los Angeles, California. And I wanted to touch on the use of a phrase that I'm hearing a lot in relation to a lot of in relation to the occurrences of violence that are highly publicized, that are being attributed to black males in the news. Most recently, there is this story of the so-called Facebook Live killer in, I believe it was Cleveland, Ohio, and subsequently in Pennsylvania. There was a phrase that was used to describe this person's, I guess, alleged pathology, and it was the toxic masculinity term. This toxic masculinity term I'm seeing bandied about online. It seems to be used almost exclusively in relation to black people. And I say black people and not just black males, because what is happening is that what I'm observing is that they're using the term to describe any black person who's exhibiting violent behavior. And it's being attributed to black males and black females. Black females are being masculinized. They're being turned into, they're being said to be unruly or exceptionally violent. And black males, this term is being ascribed to them to describe basically anything that they do. And I noted this, that this term isn't being used in relation to the Bill O'Reilly scandal at all. It also isn't being used to describe the behavior of Aaron Hernandez. who recently is said to have killed himself while he was in greater confinement. None of the behavior of people who are not classified as black, I don't know if there's any term or any blatant term to pathologize their entire group, quite like the term toxic masculinity. That term hasn't even been used to describe any of the rioters that were showing out in Berkeley earlier this week as well, in which one suspected race soldier was caught on camera assaulting a female by punching or battering a female by punching her in the face on camera. The term toxic masculinity did not come up not one time. I even did a Google search in relation to the alleged assailant and the phrase toxic masculinity. It did not come up not one time. So I'm urging listeners to be very careful when you hear the word toxic masculinity and understand that this phrase is not being used to describe anybody else other than black people. And eventually you'll start to see it be more and more applied to black females as well as black males. And it's already being applied to black females, but you will see it be applied more and more. And at this time, I'll just mute my line.
Really great point. I Googled while Mr. Steele was speaking, and on the main page, it just had like definitions, a lot of such like that. So then I went to news, and they have a photograph exactly of the alleged Facebook Live killer, alleged. They have a photo of this black male with toxic masculinity right next to his image. No photos, no articles of Bill O'Reilly at all. Not on the entire page, but they got this black male mentioned. Now, they do have Donald Trump on the page, but not Mr. O'Reilly. I was surprised Bill Cosby didn't make a cameo on this list. Any of the other folks that we have not heard from at all, if we have not heard from you at all, if you have a hand up, the number again, 641-715-3640, decode 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everyone. This is Ari from Renton. I'm glad you chose to go back home on your 2 a.m. walk, and everything was okay. You're alive, Gus. As a Washingtonian myself, being surrounded by such extreme amount of white people, I have those same thoughts when it comes to going out late at night. Sometimes not late at all, anything past sundown, I reconsider due to my increasing awareness of what racism, white supremacy is. I was born and raised here. I do enjoy the outdoors, specifically hiking and camping or playing sports outside when the weather is nice. And as the weather is starting to warm up, I'm beginning to reconsider this annual camping trip I usually attend, which is hosted by my aunt and her white husbands. And they like to drive 6 hours east of the mountains and boat to the other side of the lake and set up camp. And the previous times I've went with them, they've brought their white friends and their white children. And all I can say is, reflecting back on it, it was very trashy and tragic. So I know I definitely won't be going to any more of those. Also, the clip at the beginning of the show about why outdoors and things like hiking are mostly white also struck a chord with me, because I do like to hike during the spring and summer seasons with my non-white friends. Most of them do have white friends, unlike me, and they'll invite me to go hiking with them, and I'll decline always. Because when I have hiked with my non-white friends, every time we go and park and it's time to, like, get out the car, I'll mention about, or even before, we just, if we plan to go hiking on a day, I'll mention, like, having protection of some kind, and they kind of look at me funny, like I'm being too extreme. I'll just say maybe, like, a mace, a knife, a taser, a gun, something, but they never respond or agree, which makes it harder for me to be motivated about hiking this season with anyone or even just by myself. Since I do know when I do go to hike, I will be one of the few non-whites on the trail. And yes, white people do stare at you and watch you go into the woods or when you're in the store restocking on supplies or getting some water. Also, with the recent death of the Muslim teen Ben Kita found hanging here up in Lake Stevens, I don't know about hiking anymore because I could go in the woods and never come out. And I wonder if anyone will even think of any foul play with the way I saw the people's reactions about that story, at least the people closest to around me and how they responded to that or their lack of reaction. So that's all I wanted to share. Thanks for listening.
Right on. Excellent. Reminding us of Mr. Kita, that was like at the beginning of the year. And yeah, they just said, oh, well, you know, just another black person gone. No one who will be missed. That was right at the beginning of the year. And I think that, in fact, she mentioned that there's a book written about exactly what you just said, that as a black person, like, I could be killed and, you know, it wouldn't even be a thought. Just, oh, well, moving forward. And the area, I think Washington State, in addition to being super white, like, this is like gun country as well. That's another thing just to keep. And again, it's, I'm not saying not to go. I have been not just hiking, like overnight camping in Washington State. I'm not saying not to do it. I'm just saying the same way that you consider, now there are bears out here. That's something to consider. You take precaution about that. We're in a system of racism, white supremacy. So that might be something to consider when we do our camping or if we go at all. Just something to think about. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Folks that have a hand up that we have not heard from? Are there people that have a hand up that we have not heard from at all? I feel like we're missing people. I'm seeing hands and I guess I don't know if folks are maybe in an area where they can't speak. Do we have anyone who has actually seen the Henrietta Lacks documentary featuring Oprah Winfrey? Has anyone seen that? We did all that time on the book study session. That's definitely something, you know, I've been paying attention to, hoping some of the listeners have as well. I guess that's a no. No one listening has seen it.
No, I have not.
Dang. Okay. Well, I'm not encouraged.
First time I'm hearing about it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it was a segment where they were talking about the clip and some of the controversy in the sound clips, but it's supposed to have come out this week. I haven't seen it either. I'm just seeing if anybody, you know, was ahead and had any thoughts on it. But if you happen to see it and you want to share a thought, compensatory call in down the road, we can make time for that as well.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
I think the movie, they had just previewed today. So if we're listening to you, we're probably not watching the movie.
Ah, I see. I thought it had already aired. I see. Well, for next week.
It's the 22nd, so that's today. Right?
Got it. Got it. Got okay. It. Thank you kindly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, next week, if anyone has seen it by next Saturday or any time in between, let us know what you think.
I saw a preview.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I saw a preview. Yeah, I saw a preview of the film, and it seemed like Oprah was doing her. It sounded like the same voice that she used in The Color Purple for the main character. So, I'm not, you know, I saw this and it did not look very appealing to me at all.
Hmm. for the folks who were with us for the book study session, I don't know how surprised. I think Augustine Renegade, one of the chief things that I said as we read it, I kept saying over and over again, I don't think you could read this book and come away with a good opinion of black people. Like, I think you would, that about what you just said, that seems like a chief thing that I continue to say over and over for the duration of the book study, that I just don't think you would read this book and have a pleasant opinion of black people. And that's what they said in the sound clip, that the movie is based on the book. So, yeah. Do we miss anyone, any of the folks that had a hand up that we haven't heard from?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I'm just punching into the plantation, so I was trying to get myself situated. I didn't want you to think I was just hogging up the line here. But I did catch the first hour of the movie, the Heavy Iraq movie, before I had to leave. And it was very much like the book. It's about pretty much about the white lady, Sloop, who wrote the book. And, you know, trying to get you to empathize with her, and just as much as you would empathize with these people who lost everything, you know, including their mother, and find out that their mother's cells are being sold and didn't know for years. So I think it's been pretty accurate, and Oprah, very reminiscent. But to me, all her characters are pretty much that same downtrodden black woman. But this is very close to her character in The Color Purple after she was incarcerated. You know, when she was kind of, you know, beaten down. And that's pretty much what I got. And I'll chime in after I situate myself.
Oh, right on, right on. Appreciate that. We weren't trying to call you out, Thomas in New York, but yeah, definitely appreciate he got to see a few minutes of it. That was interesting. I noted that in the clip, that that was going to be kind of be the plot of the movie, like how Rebecca Skloot gathered this information, which is pretty much the book. Like, it's, you know, that I've said that white people, that will be their tendency. If it's a story that's supposed to be about a black person, like we had a white female author, same thing with these white women. She did a story about when they closed public schools in Prince Edward County, Virginia for 5 years. This is in the late 1950s and 60s. And she was doing a story about this, but it's ends up being a lot about her, her growing up in Virginia and what she thought about the food and hanging out with her grandparents on the farm. I mean, are we talking about white terrorism in education, or are we talking about your days growing up in Virginia? I mean, you know, it's a tendency for that. So I'm not surprised that that's, you know, what the movie is about, her trying to get trying to get all the information that she can about Negros in Baltimore, Maryland. Let's see. Just making sure folks don't wait till the last minute either. Please do not wait till the last five. If you have a question or a comment that you want to share, did we miss anybody? Yes.
Yes. So I did have a comment because I wasn't able to catch. This is my travel weekend, so I wasn't able to catch the clips. However, I did hear the whoop, there it is, nigga, and I started cracking up. Thought that was hilarious. Sad, but hilarious. And I heard the clip about the baseball equipment, and I did coach Little League for my son. I was trying to get him involved in some sporting activities, and they had a Little League team down the street where I live at Jackie Robinson Park, which used to be a very prominent league in Harlem. Apparently, everyone talks about it, but it just kind of dwindled down. And I think it's because of the equipment. When I grew up, we played baseball, but we played stickball. You know, we got a broomstick and, you know, got a bouncy ball. You kind of had to hit it over the the plate, the sewer plate, you know, and swing at it. But in the city, you know, that's kind of, you know, impossible. You know, we would always get in trouble for hitting someone's car or something with the ball, so we couldn't do it often. And I think that's one of the large reasons is that it takes space that is a green space, or preferably, and it's not a lot of that in the city. It takes finances. And Area 1, one of our biggest, probably our biggest problem is economics. In order to play baseball, you need a glove and you need a bat. You also need a ball. Unlike football, where you just need a ball, and you can go down to the, so you can play in the street or in the park, play some tackle with your friends or basketball. You know, you just need a ball, a milk crate. You can cut that out or something. It's not hard to do. It's not a lot of finances involved. Whereas baseball, that glove is about $20 to $30. If you want a good one, you're looking upwards of $100. The bats are about, you know, $30 or so. And you cleats and all those other things that are needed to play that sport, it becomes quite pricey. And most parents in the inner city, they don't have additional $60-$70 just to spend to let their kid play baseball. Also, when playing baseball, there seems to be a fee associated with playing that doesn't come with football and basketball. Normally, I guess because the league is providing the equipment, they charge a fee for the parents for the uniform and all of that stuff, and that's another additional fee on top of the fee. So I just think that they've priced us out of that sport, and I'll mute my line.
That's a good point. I was thinking that when they gave the statistical breakdown of how few black people, less than 10%, play baseball now. My thought was that that's probably what whites want. Like, they have a variety of ways of getting black people to not do things. And that, as you just stated, pricing you out will just make it so that, you know, the gloves and bats and whatever else is just a little bit too much for you all to afford. They can do that pretty easily. I was even thinking, connecting that with the hiking that was stated before, I was trying to think of the cost of that. And I mean, by the time, you get a tent and like hiking shoes, and I mean, you need gear. It's like you can't just put on a T-shirt and go out. And by the time you get your gear and all that stuff, like it does add up, you know, quite a bit, even if you're not going to REI or, you know, the designer white places to get the most expensive stuff. It still, you know, would add up to a considerable expense. And then they have fees sometimes, you know, to get into some of these national parks and what have you. You might have to get a license or a permit or what have you to even enter. So it can be kind of costly. Other folks that we have not heard from have commentary?
Jumping on that same cost prohibitive restriction placed on certain sports, I know that that's, from what I was able to observe, deliberately done in the sport of tennis. They deliberately make tennis inaccessible to victims of racism, white supremacy. Not only do they price people out of regular play because of the registration that you have to do for the USPTA, and even when you're playing for your high school, to be competitive, you oftentimes have to get private lessons. Those cost extra money, or your coaches are not going to spend any time giving you any sort of private instruction if you are having any sort of difficulty. And then on top of that, you have just the cost of equipment to be competitive in tennis. Every year they're coming out with lighter, powerful rackets, more accurate rackets. So to be competitive, to have the most competitive equipment, you're going to have to shell out or you're going to have to spend a considerable amount of money. And by the time you factor in the cost of training, equipment, court time, it becomes extremely inaccessible. And then on top of that, Oftentimes, you're going to have to train during school, and the only time to train is extremely early in the morning. So you're talking about getting your day started at 4:30 in the morning, and that's just getting on the court. So that's these, I believe, are deliberately done to keep out, you know, to prevent the sort of thing from happening that happened with basketball, football, and more popular sports that are, or sports that are popular with victims of racism. Thank you.
Can I speak a little bit on that subject?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I also and I agree with all of the previous comments on the means to restrict baseball and tennis from non-white black people from this part of the world. I also would include that those two sports require a great deal of skill. Work, and it really would help advance that particular athlete if they're doing it before they get to high school. Now, why is it significant in high school? Once you get to high school, they supply you with all of that equipment, but by that time, in those two sports especially, baseball and tennis, if you've waited till high school to get basic training, then you're probably going to be way behind the global competition in baseball, especially with the ability to hit a ball that is not coming straight. It's going in all kinds of curves and whatever, that sort of thing. It's very skill orientated. Hank Aaron, for instance, went to try out for professional baseball, and he wasn't even, I think they laughed at him because he was only like 12, 13 years old. And that's certainly not high school age. And we're talking about back about over 50 years ago or more. Well, well over 50 years ago. Very skill oriented sports. Whereas with football, you don't even have to have even played a down of football. Most of the big football players, meaning linemen, offense, defense, or some other big children, they may not have even played little league sports because they were too big. You know, they were too big for the pounds limitations that were there. And I just wanted to include also one thing that I always thought was kind of crazy. Maybe we could talk about it at some point in time, and why they always say that Jackie Robinson was the first black person to play in the major leagues, and he wasn't. He just wasn't. It was a guy by the name of Fleetwood. His nickname was Fleetwood, a black male, well before Jackie Robinson. But for some reason, they keep carrying on. You know, although I appreciated Jackie Robinson even without baseball, and what he attempted to do, similar to Dr. King. VGQ with some of the things that I may not have thought was as sound as it could be, but nevertheless, but he certainly was not the first black person in the major leagues, and that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Since well, everyone sorry, is,
sorry, I had one more. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask a quick question, and then I'll yield to Mr. Thomas in New York. Do you all see the controversy around Serena Williams? I think it happened like yesterday, where this white tennis player.
I just came across the story a few minutes before the program started.
Oh, okay. I don't know how to pronounce his first name. I think it's Ili or Ili, I-L-I-E, looks like. Natase could face censure after apparently making a racist comment about Serena Williams' pregnancy on the eve of Romania's Fed Cup playoff against Great Britain at a press conference to preview the tie in Constanta, which starts on Saturday. Romania's captain was heard to say of Williams' baby due in the autumn, "Let's see what color it has." chocolate with milk? Question mark. All that's a direct quote. Williams announced on Wednesday she is expecting her first child with fiancé Alexei Ohanin, who is white and will take time away from the tour. They in the article denote that he is white. That was not a Gus ad. I didn't know if people heard about this, but I will yield to Thomas in New York. Oh, are you with us, Thomas? He might not be able to speak.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought you hit mute fast enough. That's always my thing why I asked about coffee. It's that coffee with milk. I just noticed a different mentality from whites who drink coffee with milk than those who drink it straight. And I just wondered. So that milk chocolate is very interesting. I had a question, actually, because the guys were talking about this. But why do you think there's been a deliberate effort to keep blacks out of, in particular, baseball? It doesn't seem to affect them putting black people who speak Spanish as their first language into the sport. But why do you think it's been a concerted effort over the last, 30, 40 years to deliberately keep blacks out of that sport by taking away the Little League and pricing us out? And I only ask that because I'm wondering if this is sort of the I hate to use the OJ effect, the Haiti effect, where they're never going to let you live down that this was the sport that got integrated, or do you think it's something else? And I'll mute my line.
I can tell you. Oh, go ahead, Gus.
My quick assessment. Oh, wow. It is thundering loud outside. My quick thought is, great question. I think baseball is considered one of the four major sports. I think it's basketball, baseball, football, and hockey. And I think whites have pretty much conceded the NFL and basketball to the Negros in terms of playing. Obviously, whites control it all. But in terms of actual players that you're seeing, on the field or court or whatever it is, they've just ceded those two. And I think the same thing with hockey for everything that we talked about with baseball and hiking. I think hockey is another one that's super expensive. And do you have access to a rink? And do you have, again, that might be a financial thing. Do you have the money or whatever it's going to cost to be able to go and use the rink for practice and everything you need for all of that? So that right there is going to block a lot of black people from being able to participate in that. And then with baseball, I think it's, hey, this is one of the big four sports that white people play, dominate, and is still important. The World Series still super important, has been for a long, long time. We could just keep the niggers out of this altogether. We'll price them out, whatever it is, and all the other shenanigans that they carry on. And I think exactly as you said, we can bring in other non-white people, victims. We can bring them in from overseas or where have you, and they can be our little colored section to help our teams out. But we can have one that is almost exclusively the domain of whites. I think is what might be happening with baseball. I could be in error. Retired firefighter?
Yes. To include, I can say that the sport of baseball is more international than football anyway. I don't know about basketball, but it's definitely more international than football. Football is trying to catch up. And as I think you mentioned, Gus, that in turn that can perhaps bring in a branch out and become much more international with non-white black males. And also thanks to Kurt Flood, who literally sacrificed his life that in turn he didn't benefit from, but baseball players are still benefiting from the better and amenities of being a professional athlete with the salaries, I believe with the retirement. Football, NFL really sucks as far as that aspect is concerned. I've coached plenty of young people who today, because once they tell you can't play no more, no matter what injuries or anything like that, that's it. Everything gets cut off. But it's not that way, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, with basketball and baseball. And because of the lesser violence of the game itself, you can, if you're good, especially, you can exist in it much longer than football, of course. I mean, the time span with a football player is like 3 to 5 years for various reasons, and the physical part is definitely one of them. You are like super if you can play 10 years in the NFL, you know, as far as they're concerned, based on injuries alone. With baseball, it's not unusual for a baseball player that's not necessarily a superstar, but good, can exist around for 10 years or more, as far as they're concerned. So it's just like anything else as far as jobs are concerned, you know, and you look at it on how the structured for the employee, which in this case is the player, if it's quote unquote pretty good based on other jobs, then it's probably something that they're going to try to restrict or limit non-white people from doing. And that's my thoughts on that question.
Any other thoughts on that, or the racist commentary directed at Serena Williams, at a pregnant black female?
I believe that her fiance and the father of the child is the person who founded Reddit, and or is currently the operator or the person in charge of Reddit. And I'll also note that Reddit is the pretty much the online hub of white supremacists, and it serves as a source for new members of the website Stormfront. So it's kind of like a mainstream gathering place for white supremacists and suspected white supremacist racists to congregate and exchange ideas and to proliferate their talking points.
Well, I just thought that after reading her father's book about his life, it shocked me that her and her sister both have gone that way. It just shouldn't say shocked me. I mean, they definitely are experiencing some high levels of white supremacy coming from a very good financial standpoint. But just his stories of how he was done and the deliberate acts of racism that he spoke about so eloquently in his book, it just really shocked me that they would ever even look at anything other than a black man. And it's sad. It's very sad. As far as the comments, I think that we should expect these comments from all these people. I would love to hear the comments that we don't hear, that they don't put out there. Those are probably even very telling. But I wonder what her father thinks. Yeah.
I'm sure he is not pleased based on what we read in Black and White, The Way I See It, his autobiography back in the book club. I think it was pretty close to when we read The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Could be mistaken, but I think they were pretty close. Will be interesting to hear, because I'm sure it'll be a lot more of those comments as she continue. I think this is when she first announced it. So as it gets closer to the child being born, and you can think of all the other comments that they've made about her being a man. And I think that's with both Serena and her sister Venus, where same thing. I think we just talked about that too, the contempt for gender and to masculinize black females. I think both Venus and Serena have been subjected to that repeatedly throughout their professional tennis careers. Be interesting to see if that, you know, gets adjusted with her pregnancy now, or just how it mutates to encompass that. Do we have other?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
One thing that I noticed that was really interesting relating to Serena Williams is that she is the
campaign. They'll usually feature Serena Williams' face and the word equality, or she will be seen at events with a T-shirt that simply reads the word equality, and I believe it's like a serif font. And one thing that's really interesting about her being the face of equality is that her existence and the reason why we acknowledge her is specifically because she is superior to everybody in her field, superior to everybody in her class,
and dominant in tennis. And the fact that she is seen as the face of equality is, I believe, a misnomer. I believe it's an insult. And I believe that perhaps this arrangement that she's in might be subtly some sort of degradation of her. And I think that the way it's being positioned in the media is that it's something to be ridiculed. And I think that this most recent comment, it just plays right into that. Just the idea that somebody who is so good is the face of something like equality and not superiority or dominance or anything like that.
My thoughts come to mind that because of the parents are, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, are not together, and whatever took place to cause that, and I believe the father is in a relationship with a female that's about the ages of his children, which, you know, all of those things complicate our collective situations. And in turn, that, you know, all of that kind of like drives into the mind of a person, whether they're a celebrity or not, it doesn't make a difference on who they decide to unfortunately have sexual intercourse with. That may play a factor in those things. We've seen both of those two children to say and do some constructive things in a terms of what could be considered to be counter-racism. But at the same time, because of they are public, they are in the public all the time, we've seen the opposite also. So, me personally, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised by her about to have a child. It'll be a non-white child, but nevertheless, having sex with a quote unquote white male. Not surprised at all.
And did anybody notice how the father is not present in any of the baby bump photos, in any of the announcement photos of the expected child? I don't see any photos that include the suspected racist that is going to be the father of this offspring. Did anybody else notice that?
The father of the father of the expected father, or are you talking about
father?
Oh, okay, well, that may not be surprising either when one studies Dr. Francis Welsing's thoughts on white people not wanting to have their grandchildren as non-white. You know, that may be may greatly be a factor into that question that you asked.
Let me make sure I remind.
Yeah.
Hang on a second. Let me make sure I remind folks, because I do not want to have the waiting until the last 5 minutes and then folks deciding that they have a comment or a question about something else that was presented. So we have about 20 minutes. If you have something you would like to share, the number again is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Make sure we didn't miss anybody. Is anybody with us that we have not heard from at all who has not been able to comment? Make sure we didn't miss anyone. Any hands? The person who dialed in, 6689, did you have commentary? 6689, last four digits.
Well, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to continue the commentary about Serena Williams. And I just thought it was very weird that she would be married and expecting child with the head of Reddit, like someone else said. It was it's very weird that the head of Reddit, that, you know, is the leader of this white supremacy website, where, like Steele said, a lot of racist activity goes on there. So I thought that was very interesting. And I also think that the masculinization, I think that's what the term is, of Serena Williams, I do believe that's just a refinement of, you know, dehumanizing superior sports athletes. I remember Mr. Neely Fuller, he was talking about Jesse Owens and how they would just say, that's not fair, you know, to have black runners running the Olympics. You know, that's like running an animal out there. You know, that's what was that was the comments that whites were making back then. So I just think this is another way for them to impose that racism on Williams, and I mean black people in general.
The person who dialed in, last four digits, 9440, 9440. Did you have commentary?
Hey, what's going on, Gus, the callers this evening? My comments on the Serena thing, I just seen that. I thought it was very strange how that Romanian player made that analogy of the milk is going to be chocolate or vanilla or whatever. I thought that was very strange. But it does show you that white people they think about these things despite the denials of that they don't. It's very important they think about these things, regardless of the fact that she's in a tragic relationship or not. It's very interesting. To make a comment on the baseball real quick, I think it's something real deep to me in America with their relationship with baseball. You know, it's kind of told as baseball is like America's pastime. It was America's original pastime and things of that nature. And you know, it's like as American as, they don't like metaphors, but as American as apple pie, whatever that means. And so even some of the historical accounts, Gus, of reading from people about groups of whites, men exactly, in cars during the 50s and 40s, quote unquote, playing nigger baseball, where they have a baseball bat and they are hitting, they're trying to hit innocent black people upside the head. So, I mean, it's just, to me, in my opinion, it's just something very deep with whites in baseball. It's like it's the sport that they, it's just something. It's something with that, and I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's, you know, going back to Dr. Welsing and the baseball bat being brown and wood, and there's some serves as some phallus type of thing, or the little white baseball, and just you know, it's something real deep. And then the other side of it too is that I find interesting with baseball, that how all of these powerful white men lobbied so hard to not allow young black males to make the jump from high school to the pros because of all this money and all this pressure. But with baseball, predominantly white sport, they're able to sign contracts to minor leagues right out of high school. It's sometimes at 16, 17 years old. Even the non-white players that they're getting from these so-called, again, you know, so-called third world countries, they're signing these kids at 16, 15, you know, 17 years old, barely able to speak English, you know, living on dirt, living on, you know, homes having still dirt floors, you know, all these other things. And just talking to some of the Dominican guys over who are from these countries, these Caribbean countries, and how popular it is and how much it's almost like a harvest. It's literally like a harvest. They have baseball academies over there. That's how deep it is. And so, you know, it would seem like historical context and just from a psychological standpoint, it's something with baseball that they hold dear or that they have in their psychology that this is they don't want it. They don't want black hands on it. They don't want, you know, that domination that seems to be in the other sports where you have so-called black players. That's just my opinion. Thanks.
Let me make sure we don't have other folks that we've missed completely. Is there anybody that has a hand up that we have not heard from at all? Just making sure we didn't miss anyone. Awesome. So we got everybody. I think it, just going off what the previous caller just shared, thank you for chiming in. I think hockey and baseball, those are the two sports that have, where you have a flagrant, obvious phallic instrument that the players would have in their hand the whole time. In hockey, it's the hockey stick, and in baseball, you have a bat, obviously. I think it might be something about that, where white people, they do not want to see a bunch of black people with that, black males in particular, with a flagrant phallic symbol that might have a particular impact on the white psyche. Dr. Welsing, I don't know. It would be great to hear her thoughts on that, but just a thought. Any last 15 minutes or so? Other folks
Dr. Welsing also, they're using white balls. I wonder if that makes something. You know, they use brown balls in basketball and football, but in baseball, even in tennis, it's a green ball, but it has a little bit of white on it. You know, there's the sleeves, but I wonder if that plays. I would love to ask her that because she made a definitive point to point out that those brown balls symbolize the black man's brown balls. Golf, white ball, you're not allowed to play. And when we are, we get ridiculed, Tiger Woods. Baseball, same way. So I wonder that. Also, I wanted to point out an observation I've been making. I've been seeing it a lot in Harlem over the last few years, and now I'm seeing it has gone to reality TV, whereas all the shows that they target a black viewer audience, usually black female viewer audience, they now have implemented this Asian female who dresses like a black woman or dresses like the stereotypical black woman and talks and acts like the stereotypical black woman, the bougie type, I would say. I just thought that that's very interesting because I see them on the train dressed in everything you would see a black woman wear, not something you would typically see an Asian woman in, wearing clothes the way that very tight, very, very seductive name brands that black women typically would buy, getting their hair done in styles that black women would normally get their hair done in. And I wonder if that, if anyone else has seen that, how should we be perceiving that? Is that them making fun of us, or should we perceive it as something else?
I think a lot of people have talked about envy, but I think Pam, and I'll let the other caller answer really quick. I was just talking to Pam just talking to Pam. Hope she is doing better. She had emailed me trying to get her on the program. She had a death in the family, and she was not feeling her best like a couple months back when we were supposed to have her on the program originally. But she has been persistent and persevered, rather. Excuse me. She's persevered. And we should have her on the program soon. But Pam, she was responding to a similar question, and she said she definitely sees a lot of envy in terms of individuals classified as white being envious of melanin-dominant humans. But I'm not sure that that or, you know, spending a lot of time on that helps us solve the problem of racism, white supremacy. The other caller who spoke up, were you going to comment?
Yes, and I want to add to the crest theory discussion. You're talking about the phallic imagery. One thing that I heard on a couple of your broadcasts was we're talking about the white supremacists and their need to have the sword. And the last thing that you want any black person to have is any control of any like sword or gun. And I think that even extends to the NFL. Where a lot of gun formations are made at the quarterback position. Thus, you don't have a lot of black quarterbacks either. So I think it even extends to the NFL. As, you know, they cannot be the bearers of this sword or this gun. That's ours. That's our power.
Last 10 minutes of the broadcast. Any other comments? We had all these... folks down in Florida, I didn't hear any commentary on State Attorney Ayala having the noose sent to her office. And then State Senator, was it? I think it was State Senator Arteles, where he was, I guess he admitted that he had been calling some of his colleagues nigger. And then I guess he added an A on the end and then apologized after that. I didn't hear any commentary on all the Florida activity this week either.
Yeah, well, all of the black ministers joined together in a press conference not too far from where I'm sitting right now. One of them happened to be a relative of mine, and demanded, quote unquote, demanded that he resigned. I'm pretty sure you know by now that person resigned. I believe from their office. I was aware of that particular story, but I didn't think about bringing it up. I kind of like wanted to just briefly mention that our favorite running back that's going to be in the NFL draft and the quote unquote white victim of him hitting her settled a civil lawsuit, and this is going to make some of us sick. He apologized to this white woman, and I'm pretty sure by now all of us know on where his big bonus when he signs is going to where it's going to go to immediately, almost when he. Fields in that contract in the NFL. I'm talking about Mr. Mixon, Joe Mixon.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, folks. But I was. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just remembering the name. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was reminded of the incident. Where he, you know, what everybody saw, and in turn, they, according to the article that I'm looking at, they both met privately. They actually met privately and spoke without attorneys and whatever. The settlement came out. But I'm pretty sure I know where his first check or series of checks are going to be going to in order for this civil lawsuit case to be settled. So, interesting.
Weeping white women. Very dangerous. I remember that got a lot of commentary. I think even a white person got in trouble when they were talking about the incident on the air during that. They had a big bowl game this right at the end of 2016 or right at the beginning of the year, you know, with the dates. But yeah, I remember that got a lot of publicity at the beginning of the year. And I suspect retired firefighter is correct. This white woman is, she's probably going to be cheering more than he will when he gets his first deal. Like, man, it is about to be on celebration time. And she did a big sob story about how bad that is. Disgraceful. White women are super extra dangerous. And he was at a bar. That's what I said, going back to what I said at the beginning. That incident happened, unless my memory is real bad, they were at a bar. Now, am I saying that you got to be a coward? And, you know, if anyone ever suggests going to a bar, like, you got to run away in tears? No. But I am saying, system of racism, white supremacy, I have seen a pattern where a lot of bad things happen when alcohol is involved. You go to these bars and what have you. I've said consistently, whites and alcohol, horrendous combination. I mean, it's just, it doesn't have anything to do with who you are as a person. You can be, you know, you can be someone who doesn't drink at all, but just being in that environment, it puts you in closer proximity to just unnecessary things happening that can be easily avoided. That's all I'm saying, that, you know, these are things that should be considered. In a system of white supremacy, is horrendous that that's the world that we have. But hey, if Joe Mixon had said, oh, nah, I don't do bars, and this was at night as well, I don't do bars, I don't do white people and alcohol, and it's late, I'm going to, you know, I got a game tomorrow, I'm going to stay in my room and study or get some rest, I'll go lift some weights, but oh, no, I'm good. He wouldn't be having this problem, and I suspect his bank account would be a bit heftier over the next month or so.
Yeah. And the white woman victim, in the first hour of list watching that Henrietta Lacks story, that's what they portrayed Miss School as a victim. This black family doesn't trust her, you know, and she's so victimized and teary-eyed over it. And it just irked my nerves because, you know, so that white woman victim, very powerful.
Was there someone else who was going to comment? Thought I heard another voice.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's very, very, I've been practicing sobriety for a long time, but it's very hard, and it takes a lot of developing responses to push back against a lot of people telling you that you need to lighten up and drink a beer. Sorry for the metaphor, but yeah, drink a beer and get drunk and, you know, just have fun.
Yep, that is very popular under these conditions. And what I said consistently as well is, fine, if you're going to do that, even that should be codified. I'm not going to be at the bar. I'm not going to be around whites. I'm going to be cautious about the non-white people that I'm around. That's all I'm saying, is that the system of white supremacy, unfortunately, in order to minimize problems, it really behooves us to spend a little bit more time thinking, because it makes things, the environment is so dangerous because of the system of white supremacy, that bad things can happen, and they can happen in a very short amount of time. We have other folks who had commentary. Final few minutes.
Yeah, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I had one strange thing happen to me. Just another welding moment. Sometimes it just happened, man. So I'm at this gas station early in the morning. It's about 6 a.m. And getting my stuff basically rung up, or she's getting it. She's getting the prices and everything like that, about to get my total. And then she just breaks into this story, this awkward story about how this patron before me got all this chocolate and a whole lot of nuts. She just kept saying it. And I just kind of, I kind of smiled, but I was like, I wanted to say something so bad, so bad. But then I just was like, just hold it back. Just be quiet, just let her ring my stuff up, get your stuff, show some black self-respect, and just walk up out of there. And that's what I did. But I really wanted to say something real smart. But, yeah, I just thought it was strange. She just kept saying it.
So that's all I got.
Wow. Yeah, I think other people have kind of noted that trend of conversations, and sometimes it'll be in kind of a veiled way where they're not saying it directly, but they'll use euphemisms where they're not just not being as explicit about it, but it's still somehow getting to the genital area, something sexual, something tacky, that it'll just be a lot of it, that's what they tend to associate with black people, and that's where the conversation tends to go with whites talking to black people. I think a lot of folks have noted that, observed that trend. Let's see. Unless somebody had something that they need to get in 30 seconds.
Yes, Gus, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Really quickly, I was watching this, another one of Richard Spencer's campus appearances, and he had a Q&A, and it was a white person that asked, you know, what is white enough? And another white person says, well, do you ask a black person what's black enough? And then the black person was in the audience. She turned around and said it. And he says, well, I didn't hear you. And then they said something. And then the white person, another white person in the crowd said, there's no such thing as white enough. But that white person didn't answer her question. So I know it kind of sounds confusing, but he manipulated the Q&A person that was asking a question to him about what's white enough, and she was a white person. So I thought that was interesting. I wanted to share that real quick.
That is fascinating. That's another one. You really have to be mindful of that when white people do not answer questions, because I would have been curious to hear his response to that. What is white enough, quote unquote? But he was able to redirect it so that it totally shifted the dialogue. And that's another thing that I say, non-white people, if a white person is asked a question, non-white people should not interrupt to answer for that person or anything else. Like if a white person is asked a question, like it should just be silence, unless the person asking the question is, you know, stopping to say, hey, you're not answering my question, whatever it is, but just be silent and let them answer, because they are great at deflecting. And, you know, you can start out asking them a question about one thing, and they'll get you talking about 50 different topics that have nothing to do with the question, and an argument has ensued and everything. And by that time, everyone has totally forgotten, like, wait a minute, you didn't even answer the question. He said, exactly. And I'm submitting white people are brilliant at being able to do this skillfully, and that they are, even if they're not laughing in your face, they are thinking, got them again. Skill, I don't even answer questions. Just sit back, keep them rolling. Got any more questions? I can do it again. They are brilliant at that. That's part of our counter-racist job. Really be mindful and make sure that your questions get answered. And for people, Richard Spencer, I think everybody should know him by now. I think it's the National Policy Institute, the alt-right, as they are known, group that came up with the election. That's Richard Spencer. Played some of his audio before. We'll be here tomorrow. This is the retry for the Global Sunday Talk on Racism, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. If you have problems, questions, guest suggestions, you can't find something in the archives, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. Huge thanks to all the folks for tuning in this evening. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Looking forward to being back tomorrow and in the coming weeks, days. I will encourage folks, I can say for Gus as well, I started this off saying I went down, wanted to go to the water and chill out. It's warmer now. It's not all frigid, coldest winter that we've had in 30 years in these parts. I know it's warm. It's great. Go out, hike, go do it. But we do want to make sure that we remain codified. And I think a part of that code, sobriety, would be best under conditions of white supremacy, especially if you're going to be in a vehicle. A lot of these problems happen in behind the wheel or as a passenger. You do not want to have that be a situation where you get stopped and you're under the influence and you can't make the best possible decisions to keep yourself safe. I mean, these are life-changing moments where everything, your life, I mean, literally being alive on this earth, or you being employed, or you not being in greater confinement, all of these things can change in a matter of seconds. having a beer, having a cigarette, cannabis, any other narcotics that racists come out with, I just don't think being under the influence of those substances in those moments, I just don't think that that's going to be to our benefit. Unfortunately, I think those are things that need to be considered under the system of racism, white supremacy. Yes, even in the next 10 minutes, me having a casual stroll, I could bump into a white person. I could bump into a race soldier, and my life could be on the line in the next 10 minutes. That is what the system of racism, white supremacy means. Either that's true or it's not. If it's true, I think the best way to deal with it is to accept that as such, and then you make decisions based on truth, logic. I could be talking crazy. We will see you all tomorrow. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.